Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik Palmgren. RedIceCreations.com is the website. I'll keep the introduction short today. We have a longer show ahead of us, and we've made both segments available also to non-members, as we do now and then. I wanted you to be able to listen to the entire show, even if you don't have a membership with us. But, of course, it is due to our members that we can do this program, so we do appreciate your support. RedIceMembers.com is the site if you want to access our full archives and exclusive members content. This is also how we're able to spare you from commercial interruptions and blinking banners on the websites. Well, we've invited five gentlemen to speak about the alt-right, both what was done right in 2015 and what should be done in 2016 as we move ahead. I'll let our guests introduce themselves. Let's get to it. Gentlemen, a pleasure to have you all here. Thank you so much for being here with us. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. We will probably have some new listeners to this show here today as well, you know, from well, from Gawker, BuzzFeed, one up Salon. So, you know, I think
our fan base.
Our general fan base. Maybe from HuffPo. You know, there's so many good things coming out of Adriana's HuffPo. So, anyway, before we dive in, maybe you can give our audience a short kind of introduction. Just, you know, say a few words about yourself and what you do so our audience know who we're talking with here. I think we've had everyone with us previously, actually, but John Morgan. So why don't we begin with you, John? I always like to spend a little bit of extra time on folks who come on the show, you know, for the first time. So thank you for being here, John.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, tell us just a brief kind of introduction of yourself, if you will, John.
Well, I'm editor-in-chief of Arctos, and recently I've been acting as one of the co-editors of the new Write-On website that I started with Daniel Freeberg about 6 months ago now. And I've been doing Arctos since 2010, and I'm originally from the U.S., although we were based in India for a number of years, and for the last 2 years we've been based out of Budapest in Hungary.
Very good. We have also with us Greg Johnson. Good to have you back.
Great. Thanks for having me on. I'm Greg Johnson. I run Countercurrents Publishing. That's www.counter-currents.com. And I have a new book out called Truth, Justice, and a Nice White Country, and I hope to get a chance to plug it a few more times before the conversation is out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we have Donald Fulberg. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. And my introduction would be basically the same as John's, because we work with the same projects. I mean, I'm the CEO of Arctos, of course. One of the world's biggest alt-right or new right or true right, whatever you prefer, publishers. And I kind of want to take the opportunity to plug my book once again for like the 50th time on this show, The Real Right Returns, which has been a success story so far.
Very good. And Richard Spencer, good to speak with you again.
Yes, thanks for having me on. My name is Richard Spencer. I'm the president of the National Policy Institute, and you can find us, you can find our cultural writings at radixjournal.com. You can also find us on YouTube and on SoundCloud, where I podcast. We also publish a couple of books a year, so you could look up those on Amazon and on various subjects. So we try to be everywhere, but that's kind of what we're interested in. We're interested in publishing and raising, heightening European consciousness in North America and around the world.
All right, very good. And last but not least, we have Ramsey Paul, the leader of the alt-right, at least according to BuzzFeed, right?
Yeah, I make YouTube videos out of my mother's basement when I'm not masturbating to anime. I also like to do that. So now I'm Ramsey Paul. You can Google me and you can find all about the SPLC wrote up a nice article about me. So you can find out all about me from them. So
yeah, you're in a dark hoodie and everything. Look intimidating as ever.
I am a very wicked man, a very wicked and evil man, but I've met most everyone on here, and it's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. As I said, it's great to have you guys here. Thank you so much. I think this will be a lot of fun. And I wanted to, you know, speak a bit about 2016 today, basically, and kind of we're already 1 month into the new year, of course. But obviously, a lot of people, I think, anyway, did wake up, so to speak, in 2015. Some tremendous progress, I think, was made, at least when it comes to, recruiting people to our ranks, pretty much. Largely, I think, to the fact that the conditions also got so much worse. We had the refugee invasion in Europe, the rapes in Germany here over the New Year's, and of course in other northern European countries as well, followed by consequent cover-ups by the government and the media and all that stuff. And in the U.S., of course, there's been things recently like what happened in Baltimore and Ferguson and some of the Black Lives Matter riots and all that kind of raising eyebrows as well. But I wanted to bring you guys on and talk about what you'd like to see for 2016. You know, everything from, I don't know, proposals, suggestions, aspirations, recommendations, both for, you know, people listening, but also for people who are in kind of the sphere of producing content, all that good stuff of what you'd like to see, basically, and what people should do, you know, and what they can help with, and what concerted efforts should be made when it comes to those, you know, that are concerned, basically, for the future of the European people and those, you know, kind of outside that sphere as well. So, of course, this is a huge, it's a huge topic. I don't want to put anybody on the spot immediately and kind of answer that question. So I wanted to begin with 2015. I mean, let's just look back on that first and ask you, I wanted to ask each of you what you think was some of the reasons why, you know, more people came our way, so to speak. What was it, only because, you know, conditions have gotten so much worse, or did we do, you know, something right along the way? Why don't we begin with you, John Morgan, again?
Well, I think, like you said, it was what happened over the last year that really opened people up you know, more to our perspectives. I think more and more people are starting to realize that the same old slogans and strategies that the left, and of course when I say the left, I would have to include today's mainstream conservative movement within that as well, which is, you know, basically just as liberal these days. That people are realizing that there's never going to be any meaningful change from those sectors. So they're looking for alternatives. And all of us on this broadcast have been engaged now for many years in disseminating materials, both in print and on the web and through conferences and so forth. And I think it's finally starting to have an impact. I think people are starting to see us as a genuine alternative to the mainstream. It's a, you know, a metapolitical victory, I think you could say. Well, maybe victory is too strong a word yet, but a metapolitical possibility that we've opened up.
Right, right. Let's kind of do this in the order we did the introductions, I guess. So let's go over to Greg Johnson.
Well, the reason why people are coming our way is that, first of all, we established a presence and a track record. We have a huge amount of good material that we put out. And then, yes, events have cooperated in our favor. So it's really both. We've done something right, and now our people have ears to hear, and it's very, very good that we prepared something for them to hear. We have a good message. We have media for getting that message out, and we're reaping the rewards. The traffic at Countercurrents over 2015 grew dramatically, and I am expecting that as 2016 winds on, we're going to see even more traffic. The only thing that hasn't grown, interestingly enough, is the number of people who are donating money to Countercurrents. We have a lot more people consuming free information off the internet, but we don't have more donors yet. But that will come.
Yeah, interesting. Mr. Friedberg, how about you?
Yes, I think I totally agree with Greg here. I mean, it's a combination of the events that have taken place, especially in Europe with the migrant crisis and the refugee situation, and the fact that we have that the alternative right, I mean, I use it in the broadest possible sense, including like the new right or true right or whatever, and we have kind of gotten our act together. We have become much more professional. We have become much better at getting our message out. We have launched a number of new projects and quite successful projects. And when it comes to Arctos, I mean, 2015 was our best year yet by far. And it looks like 2016 will be even better. I mean, now in January, we broke a new sales record and the month has not even ended yet. So it's looking very, very positive, I think. And I also agree that since more and more people are seeing these problems, they are It's kind of a shock that that happened during 2015 with this huge, huge invasion that took place in Europe and all the sexual assaults and so forth. More and more people are naturally starting to look for alternatives, for alternative media outlets that are not lying to them and that are not trying to cover these events up. And here we are, I mean, providing that for them. And that is a fantastic service we are providing, and we are getting better and better at it. And we basically just need to continue doing what we're doing and try to become as good as possible and continue to improve in that regard.
Richard, what do you think?
Yes, you know, our last conference in Washington, D.C., Become Who We Are, was really inspiring in terms of the amount of people who came. We basically doubled attendance from what we've previously done, and I think it's actually going to keep going from there. But there are a couple of other things that were maybe even more inspiring, and that is that when I was meeting people there, I have been used to attending these conferences. I've attended more than I can even remember. And I remember basically seeing the same faces, the same tired, frustrated, older faces. And I don't really mean that as an insult, because I think there actually are a lot of people who have been dedicated to our ideas, who've paid the price, who've been, you know, willing to keep going even when there was, you know, so much pressure against them. So I think those people are heroes in a way. But I'm used to seeing those faces. And in our 2015 conference, which was on Halloween, appropriately enough, last year, there were all these new faces. And I would talk to people, and they would say that I came to these ideas 6 months ago. And I had never experienced that before, of just new people. And these are also really high quality people, high quality new people coming to this for the first time. I just think it's an amazing thing that these people are out there. The other thing, as I mentioned in my speech at that conference, people are being red-pilled, you know, to use this great metaphor that we've taken from The Matrix. People are being red-pilled as we speak, and it's not because of anything that we on this podcast have done. They're being red-pilled by life. They're being red-pilled by the refugee crisis. They're being red-pilled just by the just total bankruptcy of the mainstream right and left, in a way. And so they're looking for something. And I think a lot of them probably have, you know, you could say devolved into a kind of cynicism about life, cynicism about their bourgeois lives. They've devolved into, you know, getting interested in nihilism or being a pickup artist or whatever. But I think it's really our task to present that, you know, way out. It's our task to say, you know, there is another way of being. There's another way of thinking about the world. There's another way of doing politics. And so I think that is what our movement, you know, is doing, and that's what we should be doing. And again, I don't, you know, just to put it in brutal economic terms, we're going to have a demand glut for our stuff. It's coming. And we just need to be ready to supply it. We need to supply it with ideas. We need to supply it with, you know, events and gatherings. We need to supply it with, you know, literature and art. You know, that is basically our job. And but I think in terms of the demand, we're going to be overwhelmed by the demand in the next decade, because it's coming. I think what we just saw this year is just really the beginning.
Yes, indeed. Ramsey Paul, how about your viewership? Has that grown as well?
Oh, yeah, huge. And speaking on what Richard said, it was interesting. A few months ago, I had a couple called me, and they're going through Tulsa. That's where I live. And they said, hey, can we meet up? And I'm like, yeah, sure. So I said, let's meet up at this pub. And then all of a sudden, I get a call from them. They're like, oh, we can't go in there. And I'm like, well, why not? And they said, we have to be 21 to get in. And they're 19. And that's what's so encouraging is it's so young now, too, the movement is what we call the alt-right, at least. Well, I would say worldwide, because when I was in Romania and Hungary, the people that watch us and are involved in it, they tend to be in their 20s or even younger. So that I think that is so hopeful. And I think another thing that's really helped our growth too, and I don't know if it's him or it's more of a, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg, but is Donald Trump in a sense, even though he may not be officially alt-right, he's bringing a lot of the ideas of what identity is and borders. And with his friend Ann Coulter, I mean, she tweets stuff that could be straight alt-right material. She's got a huge platform. So we're really seeing it exploding. And I can't tell you the number of people. I don't want to do it because it sounds like I'm name-dropping. I'm not. But I've had people contact me that are well-known that are like, yeah, Ramsey Paul, don't say anything, but we really support what you guys are doing. We just can't say anything yet. So I always say we're kind of like the iceberg. You just see the top 10%, but there's like this huge growth of people that realize the traditional, at least in the United States, Republican Party really don't have any answers for them. They want something different. They want something that they can be not ashamed of who they are, their identity. And I think that's what the alt-right brings.
Yeah, let's hammer that out, by the way, with the term alt-right. Where does that come from?
Me, I guess.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I don't want to sound too arrogant or self-indulgent. And I'm sure there, you know, as with everything, I'm sure there's a precedent. There's someone who used the term alternative right in, you know, 1994, and he's listening to this podcast and, you know, smoke's coming out of his ears. But I started to use that term around 2008 when I was the editor of Talkies magazine. And I think it's an interesting term, and I think it's maybe a necessary term. And what I mean by that is that what I was referring to, I wasn't referring to any specific agenda in the sense that we have this economic policy, we have this foreign policy, we have this social policy. I was basically referring to people who I think grasp a few things. They grasp, A, the just total bankruptcy of the conservative movement. I mean, maybe you shouldn't even call it bankruptcy, because bankruptcy implies that it was one day had wealth of ideas and things like that. The total stupidity of what is called conservatism in America. And this just desire that we need to start from a totally different standpoint. We don't need to be people who say, oh, we're the true conservatives. You know, we really do what Buckley imagined in 1955 or something. But people who are like, no, we're starting out from a totally different standpoint. I would say sometimes that standpoint was, you know, a religious standpoint. Sometimes that standpoint was a kind of hyper-liberal or libertarian standpoint. But I would say that the vast majority of that time, that standpoint was an identitarian standpoint. It was people who grasped that race is real. Race has tremendous amount of effect on society and culture and politics. And that not just that, but race is a source of identity. And I think that is the basic starting point of the alt-right. I don't think an alt-right even makes sense if you don't start from there. Anyway, so I started using this term. I actually created a website in March of 2010 called alternativeright.com. And it was a continuation of a lot of stuff that I was doing at Talkies Magazine, but it was just kind of more so. And I think it was, you know, it was interesting because at that point, it was really pretty singular, you know, when I first started. I mean, there wasn't countercurrents, there wasn't so on. There was basically some paleoconservative online magazines and something like VDare, which is a kind of, you know, conservatism plus immigration magazine. And, you know, 5 years on, there's now more web writing than I can keep up with in any day. There's just been an explosion of the alt-right in the sense that I imagined it, in the sense of a lot of people with a ton of different perspectives, but people who started from a understanding of the importance of race to the world, but also the importance of race to any individual's identity, that, you know, you're not just an atom, you're part of something. And so it's been a kind of amazing ride. I mean, the alt-right is much bigger than me, much. And I think it kind of, and it's, I think it's also a good, hashtag in the sense that there's so many people on Twitter who are these people who I talked about who are being red-pilled. They're being red-pilled by life. And they don't know what they are yet. They don't have a political philosophy. They don't have an agenda, but they know that they want something radically different. And I think that that alt-right is just a great label for it. It's like, you know, part of my French, but it's, you know, fuck you, National Review. You know, I'm alt-right. I'm doing something that's real. And in that sense, you know, it's been really, it's been, you know, very flattering and inspiring, and I'm proud of the alt-right term. It's something bigger than I am.
Yeah. Is there, do you want to add something to that further?
Sure. I like the alt-right term as well. I mean, in Europe, the term new right has kind of been the prevalent term for our movement. But the alt-right is a bit wider, and it kind of includes the new right and it's kind of synonymous in some ways as well. And I mean, it includes identitarianism, nationalism, true conservatism, and I mean, what Evola used the term, the true right. I would agree with Richard that it's a good term to use, because it's so wide that it's easy to get people to kind of gather around that specific term.
Yes, indeed. Now, if we kind of take that position that it's largely, life, the things that has happened recently that has red-pilled people, as you said, Richard, if it's due basically then to the complete, collapse of our leadership when it comes to looking after the people they're supposed to represent, I guess we could extend that to really to the business world. We could, include the university environment and stuff like that, too. They've just dropped the ball completely. But that means then that we're in a position where we just catch the people who have lost faith, if you will, in the system and have fallen off the mainstream. Is there anything that we can do now in 2016 then to move kind of further ahead and get to a place where, we not only become a real tangible opposition that is attracting people to it, but not just become reactionary in the sense that we're reacting to, you know, whatever the mainstream is doing, and then, you know, although that's a good strategy, it's cost a lot of people to come over to our side, etc. But can we move further ahead and become a force that actually is attracting people to it even before they've lost, you know, faith in the system? It's a quite difficult question, but it ties into basically what we can do and should do, what we should spend time on in 2016. Let's go over to Greg Johnson on that. Any thoughts on that, Greg?
I'm not quite sure what to say to that. I do think that our entire goal should be to drive debate rather than just respond to what's going on in the mainstream. That's what the left does, right? The left pulls the mainstream in its direction when the center and the right are just starting to react to and assimilate what the left has been demanding. They come up with a new set of demands. They move the goalposts. And we have to replicate that dynamic, but we have to get everything moving in the correct direction. And so my attitude, as far as my own activity, is this. I'm going to set up the goal of ethnostates, and I'm going to come up with proposals that are reasonable and moderate and humane, by which we might actually move from our present situation to ethnostates. And I'm going to keep that flag flying, and then I'm going to engage in as many ways as I can with the existing political debate so that my name and my ideas get out there, and then I'm going to try and drag the mainstream in my direction. I'm going to try and influence people who set up more moderate positions between me and the mainstream, and I'm going to try and make sure that that flow moves in our direction rather than the leftward drift that really is dominant in politics today. The leftward drift exists because the left always holds to its basic convictions and demands that the world move in their direction, and we have to replicate that by holding to our basic convictions and demanding that the world move in our direction, and yet at the same time we have to be extremely pragmatic in terms of means. I'm very dogmatic and inflexible about ends, right? And I think we have to be, because if we have the correct goals, then you can't improve on perfection. But you can improve upon the ways that we get to these ends. And so I'm very pragmatic about exploring new media, exploring new messages, interfacing with different constituencies, and I really have a kind of pluralist strategy there. I'm really happy when new people pop up on the web, right? New websites, new protest groups in the real world, anything that I think can advance the ball in our direction. I look at this as sort of like an experiment phase, right, where we're trying to find the memes and the organizations and the different ways to go forward. And then we'll call the worst out and we'll promote the best. But we have to keep that drift moving in our direction. And we have to keep moving the goalposts once we establish that, once we can get moderate, sensible nationalist governments elected in Europe, then we have to move the goalposts towards more radical positions and more radical positions, and we have to drag the mainstream in our direction.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what the left has done. John, you would have had something to this?
Yes, along with what Greg was saying, is I think it's very important that we have a positive message, because something that I see as a problem on the right is that people on the right have a very good idea about what they oppose, and they have a tendency to complain a lot. I mean, I'm guilty of this myself sometimes, but we have to know what it is that we want, and we have to be able to convey this to people in a way that's attractive. I mean, of course, it's important to, you know, point out what's wrong with society the way it is, but I think to really inspire people to become part of a new movement, you have to offer them a vision of what you want. And this can only be achieved, I think, by, conveying new ideas, positive ideas for, you know, what a different sort of society in keeping with our ideas would look like, as well as also new myths. I think it's very important to offer works of literature, music. I hope one day people in our movement can even produce films, offering people a vision that's consistent with the ideals that we uphold. Because too much negativity, which I think is something that's a real problem on right-wing blogs and discourse in general, I think is depressing to people. And you know, while some of it is necessary, I think in order to attract people, we really have to show, well, like Alex Kurdajic said a couple of years ago in that famous Masters of the Universe talk he gave at NPI,
yeah.
He said we have to convey images of ourselves from a position of strength, not emphasizing our weakness, but showing ourselves as a true alternative, as people who could really lead our civilization. I think that's the kind of vision we need to present.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Richard, you have something to pick up on there, too, in terms of reaction?
Yeah, I agree with so much of what is said. I might disagree around the edges, but I'm afraid this conversation might be a huge love fest. I guess that's not a bad thing. I would, there's this interesting thing about the power of the left. I wouldn't actually articulate it like Greg said, where they hold on to their convictions. I think the left is actually amazing in the sense that it's mutable. The left isn't holding up, Stalinism or socialism in one country or old style socialism of the government must own the means of production and so on. They actually never hold fast to these ideas. They're very flexible and mutable, and you could say kind of demonic. I think there are some essentials to the left. There's some really essential ideas, ideals that they would never let go of, and they do hold on to those. But they're actually mutable and flexible, and I think that's what makes them so powerful. I do completely agree that the right, as we've seen it in the United States and in Europe, and there are some differences, major differences, but actually there's a lot of common ground, really is a reactionary force. The left acts and the right reacts to the left. And I think, one thing that I think is really great about our movement, even if we're totally underfunded and we're just a bunch of bohemians, publishing stuff on the internet and publishing books and holding little conferences, the fact is we aren't doing that. And we really are setting an agenda to the degree that we can. And I think that is something definitely to be proud of. I would warn, I think we should, I totally agree with pluralism. I think I would love to see more stuff. You know, the amount of podcasting that's coming out, I think is a really great thing. Certainly web writing, Twitter is totally insane. I think this is all great stuff. I would warn a little bit about politics. And I think the Donald Trump phenomenon has been an amazing thing. I think he's energized us. I think it's just, the whole thing's just great. He has humiliated the mainstream right. That is an end in itself. I would warn people about this idea of wasting our time supporting candidates, and B, thinking that we're winning just because someone who says they're conservative wins an election, say in Poland or something like that. I think our battle and where we can actually have an impact really is metapolitically. And I think even if we want to play politics to a degree, we have to play it metapolitically. I think the conservatives have wasted a tremendous amount, an unfathomable amount of time, resources, and money playing politics. And the right has basically won nothing. The left doesn't always play politics. The left plays culture. And the left is the dominant force in our society. I think that's what we need to do. I think we need to offer an alternative vision. I think we need to offer a new vision for the world as a metapolitical one. I would warn people against thinking that because, you know, a Polish party that's about family values and about bringing NATO into their country and is pro-American, that that's somehow some great move forward for, you know, our movement. I think our movement really has to be bohemian. It has to be alternative. We have to be demanding that people start from a new basis point. Politics is a lagging indicator. Culture and social change comes first. Politics comes later, and oftentimes politics comes decades later. I think a lot of the things that we see that are, you know, we might think are inspiring in the United States and in Europe are still kind of based on paradigms that are, you know, circa the Cold War. I think our job really is to start imagining in the future politics starting from a new basis. And I think we're all actually pretty much in agreement with that. At least I would hope so.
Ramsey Paul, jump in here.
Yeah, I was going to add to what Richard said. I think really the key is who will be our Norman Lear? And what I mean by that, Norman Lear was the guy in the 70s that took a lot of these cultural Marxist or leftist ideas, but he popularized them in like popular entertainment, like All in the Family, MASH, all those shows that were funny, normal people would watch, kind of laugh, but they're kind of pushing a message on their agenda. And that's what's really effective, because like Trotsky and the intellectuals are really important. But then after the intellectuals, you gotta make it entertaining for people. And I think this really what happened in 2015. And getting back to John's point, is it's become more fun and popular, and people like it. I mean, there's the silly, you know, memes you see now, like Pepe the Frog, that has the establishment conservatives all upset and in tears. And people love that, especially young people. And I think that's really the key, is to take what the intellectuals do, and then translate that into something that's fun for people, and they can see it's not just all serious, and it's just not all, you know, we're all doom and gloom and raw old people just upset, and it just adds to the energy. So I think that's a key thing to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think, Greg?
Well, one of the things that I thought was a major sign of progress in 2015 is ideas coming out of the broadly alternative right started actually driving mainstream debates. And the best example of that, I think, was the consternation over the conservative meme. That came from our territory, and it got the mainstream all a flutter. I also think that one of the very positive things that's happening is that the left is now using us as a stalking horse or as a cudgel to beat the mainstream right. They're trying to link Donald Trump to us, and he seems to be not too unhappy about that, and I'm delighted, right? They're using us, they think, as a way of discrediting the conservatives to their advantage. But I honestly think that we're getting a lot of coverage that is going to benefit us more in the long run then it will redound to the benefit of the left. And it's really, really interesting to see the mainstream right, the pool is just draining, you know. The recent National Review anti-Trump issue really, I thought, was indicative of how utterly bankrupt they are. And then the commentaries, which I took part in, and in the follow-up article by this fellow named French, are really, really running our way. And that is one thing I think that is a really positive thing over the last few years, is that wherever you have reader comments on news stories and opinion pieces, our ideas are massively represented there. We have a real troll army. And the thing is that in these little image boards and discussion forums and things like that, you have a lot of underemployed or unemployed, college-educated, boomerang generation kids who are living at home with their parents with $100,000 in college debt and maybe a part-time job stocking shelves at Trader Joe's, and they're really angry. These are our proletariat, right? These are the kinds of people that the movement has been asking for a long time. We've been complaining. I remember 15 years ago hearing people complain, we don't have any college-educated people. As soon as they come out of college, they get a great job, they get a mortgage, and then the system co-opts them. Well, the system isn't co-opting young whites anymore, young college-educated whites, and they're some of the people who are driving this meme culture. And the stuff that they're coming out with, the videos, the parody songs, the memes, they're just devastating. This is high-level propaganda, and it catches eyes, and it's exciting, and it's drawing in a huge number of people in its wake. And so I'm very, very happy that we are now shaping the parameters of public debate, and that is what metapolitics is all about, changing the parameters of debate. Trump is very good. He doesn't believe the stuff that we believe. I don't know what he believes, but he's like this huge icebreaker, right? He's just, crashing through the crust, the frozen crust of convention, and he's releasing all these turbulent waters underneath, and we're crowding into the breach that's opened up by him, and I think it's a tremendous opportunity. And politics in 2016 is going to be, if nothing, extremely entertaining.
Yeah, exactly. More extreme, too. Daniel, you wanted to add to that?
Sure. I totally agree that, metapolitics it kind of predates parliamentary politics, and it's, of course, what we should focus on, and it's the most important thing we can do right now. But we also have to recognize that there is a symbiosis between metapolitics and real politics, and at some point you have to kind of reap the results of the metapolitical success you're having, which has happened in many European countries. I mean, we can see lots of the parties that are semi-nationalist or somewhat alt-right or at least true conservatives gaining a lot of ground recently, and the one of the biggest benefits of this is that when they get into a governmental position, like for example in Hungary and Poland, they can kind of clean up the cultural sector from all the crazy leftists and put some decent, more rational right-wing people in place instead. And that is that because many of these parties, they have understood the importance of metapolitics and that they can't let the cultural sector stay within the hands of the left. They need to do some sort of cleanup operation, which has happened in Hungary and is currently happening in Poland. When parties get to that point, we can see the real results. I mean, in Hungary, the right has not complete metapolitical dominance, but they are pretty close to it. And in Poland, they are also kind of getting there, which is very interesting because they control a large portion of the media and the cultural sector right now. And even the parties that hasn't haven't quite gotten there yet, or politicians like Donald Trump, of course, which I think is a very positive force right now as an icebreaker. I mean, in Sweden, for example, we have the Sweden Democrats. They're not really exerting any influence yet, but they are working just like Trump as an icebreaker. They're opening up the debate for topics that were previously impossible to discuss. And we have the same situation in most Western European countries, that we have quite large parties that are anti-establishment, they are anti-immigration, and they are helping out with the metapolitical struggle by acting as icebreakers, basically. So we shouldn't discount their work.
Well, there's been so much agreement on this podcast that I was wondering if maybe we should just start talking about sports or, you know, our favorite aftershaves or something, just so we can have an argument of some sort, because that's kind of what people like. But I will actually disagree with what Daniel has just put forward. I am not at all as sanguine about right-wing parties, so-called, or ethno-nationalist parties in Europe. I just can't be. I don't think we had any metapolitical effect on their worldview. A lot of these parties have been doing this kind of thing for decades. I think parties in Poland, this current one that's winning, is almost like a parody of a party that is living in the Cold War in the way that they view the world. I don't think that electing, I would say Hungary, Viktor Orban put me in jail, but I would vote for the man anyway. I truly do respect Viktor Orban, and I am not mad at him anymore. That being said, I have a very difficult time believing that the right is in control of metapolitics in these countries. I think we ultimately live in a post-liberal age. I think the age that we are talking about, what we really want to see, is something that is coming in the future, and it's going to be very different from this paradigm that has been dominating the world for centuries. I think there is a danger of wasting our time helping, you know, politicians that do nothing for us, and spending money on them and so on and so forth. I think there's also a danger of ever being satisfied with a politician, that some, you know, family values candidate or ethno-nationalist wins in some place, and we think, oh, this is leading towards what we want. I don't agree with that. I think there's going to have to be a major paradigmatic change in our consciousness that is taking place. I think the liberal age is coming to an end, believe me, but this is taking place. But that is going to be the basis for a politics of the future. It's going to look very, very different than anything that we see now. So I think it's fine for us to praise people when they deserve it, and praise someone like Viktor Orban. But I don't think we should ever be satisfied with them. I think Trump might be even a little bit kind of different. And then I totally agree with Greg. He's this weird icebreaker where it's not so much what Trump himself believes. I don't think we know what he believes. But I think he's just opening up all this amazing space. And just by humiliating, just taking a piss on the conservative establishment, it's like a liberation. People feel like they can speak, and so I think that's been really an amazing thing. I would mention, and someone could jump in if they want to disagree with what I just said, but yes. I would mention also that I kind of have, I wonder about the left. The left is, and I would say not just the left, but just mainstream journalists are interviewing us. They're taking an interest in us. They're quoting us and actually quoting us accurately. Even if they want to be critical, they still are interested in us. I have given more mainstream interviews in the past 9 months than I've given in the past 4 or 5 years. I mean, there has been just a significant increase in journalists who want to talk. We were on the cover of the we were on the front page of the New York Times, which was a little bit bizarre and surreal, but I agree that this kind of publicity is very good for all the people who look at that and say, they're evil. Oh, you know, they have cooties. I think there's good people who are like, well, let me Google this. Let me see what's going on here. But I almost wonder if at some psychological, maybe kind of unconscious level, where I wonder if the left actually wants people like us to be the right secretly, that they secretly do have contempt for conservatives for the obvious reasons that they're just a bunch of weaklings. And I think I almost wonder if the left in their secret fantasy nightmare actually wants people like us to be the mainstream right. And we're kind of seeing that, that we're more interesting. And you should always be more interesting than your opponents. I think that's the best way to beat them.
Yeah, go ahead, Daniel.
Yes. Yeah, of course. I think Richard must have kind of misunderstood me or misinterpreted what I just said. What I meant by this symbiotic relationship was not that we should blindly support any anti-immigration party or anything, only that we should see this, we should view this struggle that we're in as some sort of a joint effort, well, when we can actually have a lot of use for these parties. I mean, I'm never satisfied. I don't think we should ever be satisfied. I mean, that's the main advantage of the leftist strategy, because they're never satisfied. They have this extremely utopian vision of the future that will never come to pass. On their way there, they just keep destroying and destroying the Western civilization. And we should pretty much take a similar stance. We should never be satisfied. But that doesn't mean that we can't realize the use and the use we have for these parties and these politicians' success. I mean, we need parliamentary representation. We need some people in government that are willing to clean out the most extreme left from the cultural sector, from the media, to kind of help with the metapolitical struggle, which I, of course, view as the most important one. That's why I've been involved in it myself for the last 20 years. I also want to agree with Richard that I am just as he, I've also noticed a growing interest in us, in the alt-right, so to speak, throughout Europe, and especially in Sweden. I mean, I've given more interviews during the last year than in the past 10 years, basically. And they've been, I mean, the articles have been somewhat favorable, at least a lot more favorable than ever before. Mm-hmm. They actually... Yeah. Now they actually portray us as that we are well connected, well educated. We are intellectual, and therefore we are, of course, extra dangerous. But still, it kind of creates some sort of mystique around us that is very attractive to this growing amount of people that are looking for alternatives. So I view this as something very positive.
Right, right. I know you wanted to jump in here, Ramsey Paul, as well, but this points, we can talk about this later too, but it points to this important aspect of, finding common ground and supporting each other, even if it is up to a certain point, even if it is just on the one question, and, you know, to establish, to win that battle, so to speak, and then move on from there. And, you know, see who your allies is, et cetera. We can get into that. But Ramsey Paul, please get in here.
Yeah, an interesting conversation. And it goes beyond of, like, really what we are. The whole concept is more than traditional white nationalism. And when I went to Europe, and John, I think you know this girl I'm talking about that was with us at dinner, if you remember her.
Yes.
Yeah, very memorable. Anyway, she's very young, and we were talking, and she was like, well, what's white nationalism? And I won't say what country she's from. She's just from Eastern Europe. And I said, well, white people, like French. And she goes, oh, okay, cool, yeah. And I said, you like German? She goes, yeah, I think I can like it. And then I said, like Russians. And she's like, what the fuck you say? And I said, Russians. She's like, not Russians. And it was because of her background of the ethnic rivalries that exist in Europe still between, let's say, Hungarians and Romanians and Russians and so forth, there's less of the concept of white, I think. Although I think that's maybe disappearing, and I could ask some of the European people on that, but there's still a lot of these ethnic rivalries that I've noticed just from going to Hungary and Romania that in the United States, we really don't have that as much. We're just seen as kind of white people. So there's kind of the question of, you know, identitarianism, the way I look at it, is to respect Hungarians from being Hungarians, Romanians, Romanians. It's not necessarily this whole big white nationalism, but I know there's some conflict in there. So I'd like to hear other people's opinion on that.
Richard?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about this last time, and it's, I mean, you raise a good point in terms of, you know, how does our enemy see us? But at the same time, I mean, it has to be understood when someone says, you know, white nationalism, you know, and put that label on me, I kind of like, I don't know. Well, I'm Swedish and I'm a nationalist, so, but and Swedes are white. So yeah, technically that's correct, I guess.
Yeah, I'll be real quick and then I'll let others talk. I think that I've often asked this question, what can Americans learn from Europeans? And then what can Europeans learn from Americans? What can Americans learn from Europeans? A tremendous amount. We need to desperately learn from European identitarians a sense of history and a sense of people and a sense of destiny and culture. We can't be a movement based on black crime rates and IQ test scores. But that being said, I actually think that Europeans can learn something from Americans. And maybe we have one lesson to give them. That's it. But that lesson is that we have overcome ethnic rivalries and differences. And I think that actually is a tremendous achievement and should not be underestimated. You know, for all the things that we've done wrong, we have done one thing right. And I would also say that I agree clearly ethno-nationalism is real. Ethno-nationalism is powerful. And not just ethno-nationalism, but ethnic hatred is real and powerful. And it might very well be one of the driving forces in contemporary politics. But if you really look at where the arrow of history is pointing, it is not pointing towards ethno-nationalism, period, end of statement. This refugee crisis, if anything, are the refugees differentiating between the Welsh and the Bavarians and Italians? No. The refugee crisis is a racial crisis. In the eyes of our enemies, we are not Welsh or Italians. They have no earthly idea what that even means. In the eyes of our enemies, we are white. And how our enemy defines us is very important. It might even tell us something that we don't understand, that they understand on a deeper level. So I think, you know, I would never deny that ethno-nationalism has meaning. I don't want to see a homogenized Europe where it's all one big, you know, Americanized shopping mall. Believe me, I don't want to see that. But I think we need to, this is what we need to do. We need to start moving towards where history is taking us, where history is telling us where our destiny is. And that is in a broader European consciousness. And it is not in a kind of ethno-nationalism, which again, when you make this division between friend and enemy within the race, I don't think this is really helping us. And again, ethno-nationalism as an ideology is a kind of 19th century thing, you know, like every people needs its own democracy, you know, like as if we care about anything like that. So again, I think in a way, I don't like the term white nationalist either. I don't think that's the best term. I kind of like identitarian. But I think there's actually a meaning towards if you take white nationalism, you know, as a term that has a deeper meaning. I think it is a good term in the sense that it is about we as a race. And I think identitarianism, if it's going to be powerful, if it's going to be the ideology of the future, it has to have a number of different concentric circles of identity. One of those is your local identity, your identity of your town. One of those is maybe a broader regional identity, or maybe a sub-racial identity, like I'm a Slav, I'm an Italian, you know, kind of thing. But at some level, that racial identity has to be paramount, and it has to be the center of everything. We cannot have another century in which we define friend and enemy within our race.
Yeah, indeed. Greg?
Well, I think it's possible to have nested levels of identity. I did an interview recently with a Swedish fellow, Fredrik Hagberg, about Nordic youth, and he put it really nicely. He said, well, I'm Swede, I think of myself as a Scandinavian, and I think of myself as a European. You can think of yourself as all three of these things. You can think of yourself on multiple levels. And I think that ethno-nationalists do think of themselves on multiple levels. Certainly the ethno-nationalists I know in Europe are passionately attached to their own homelands, Lithuania or Estonia or Sweden or Hungary. And yet they also recognize that they have things in common with other European countries, and that Europeans have common enemies. And I think that you can do justice to all those different levels of identity. In terms of what the best political order is, I think the best political order is for the sovereignty of a people. That means the ethnostate. I think that I think everyone needs a room of their own, a home of their own, a country of their own, where they can go to and where they can live according to their own lights, and they don't have to justify it to anybody else. Okay, and I think that the arrow of history, I think, is pointing towards the breakdown of multinational, multi-ethnic empires into sovereign states, and I don't think that direction is going to change. I do not think that the Czechs and the Slovaks are ever going to be part of a single sovereign nation again. I do not think anyone's going to put Yugoslavia back together again. I think that if there's going to be political cooperation and organization on a continental level or a racial level, it's not going to be in the form of some kind of racial superstate or sovereign entity. It's going to be in the form of treaty organizations and alliances, things like that. And so I think that, you know, I think ethno-nationalism is really the most realistic idea, provided that there is a supervening level of common racial awareness. And wherever I look in the European ethno-nationalist movements that I'm familiar with, I see both those levels of identity, and I see that people are negotiating the treacherous issues pretty well. It was very interesting.
Ukrainians? Really? There.
Yeah, I think the Ukrainians are doing a good job.
That's truly absurd. They are murdering white people. And you think that's a good
thing? And white people are murdering
everyone.
Yeah, and white people are murdering them. And that's why they need separate states. And they need this is why we need sovereignty. So we're not so we don't have two competing governments in the same borders. So you know, the people I know in Eastern Europe, such as Lithuanians and Poles, people like that, they're, you know, the Eastern European map is a mess in terms of ethnicities. There are ethnic Hungarians in Ukraine, in Slovakia, in Serbia, in Romania. You know, there are tripwires. I guess there are ethnic Poles in Belarus and Lithuania, Lithuanians in Belarus. And, you know, it's a difficult situation. And I think that the ethno-nationalists I know are certainly the ones who are most sensitive to trying to do justice to both their own ethnic interests, take their own sides as members of a people, but also to, try and do justice to the greater racial whole. So, you know, I don't think that it's, there are perfect solutions yet, but I think that eventually, put it this way, if ethno-nationalist parties come to power in various European countries, I think those are going to be the parties that are most capable of resolving ethnic differences between, you know, different countries in the East, especially.
Yeah, I think the problem, of course, in Ukraine is that we have the Victoria Newlands in their meddling, of course, which is what's causing a big problem. In other words, they're not kind of, you know, true to their own nationalism, if you will. But, Daniel, I think you wanted to get in there and pick up on something here.
Yes, I did. Greg actually kind of got most of the things I wanted to say included in his latest statement. I totally agree with him that that there are several levels of identity. I mean, for Europeans at least, you have your national identity. You have your, for example, for me as a Swede, I have the Scandinavian identity as a second concentric circle after that. And then after that, I'm a European. And after that, I'm also a white person. And therefore, I think the term white nationalism is simply not going to fly in Europe. We have a different type of nationalism here. But that doesn't mean we have to resort to national chauvinism and have more brothers wars, which have plagued Europe for the past several centuries. But I simply don't think that will going to happen anytime soon anyway, because every time Europe has been facing an external civilizational threat, I mean, for example, the invasion of the Moors or the invasion of the Ottoman Empire, we have always banded together and united against this common threat. And that is exactly why we're going to accomplish this once again, facing this huge migrant crisis or invasion, which it really is. So I don't expect any European civil war between nation states anytime soon. I think we will have more European unity, but without necessarily having to rally around this white nationalism or common European nationalism concept. I mean, we know for a fact that we are part of the same civilization and that we have to defend it. And pretty much every nationalist from every country in Europe understands this, even though they regard themselves as, for example, a Hungarian nationalist or a Polish nationalist or a French nationalist first. But they still understand the need to come together to take care of this common threat together.
I truly hope you are correct. I think you're engaging in a lot of wishful thinking.
Well,
I am correct on this.
let's pick up on that a little bit here. John, I wanted to switch over to you a little bit and then actually go around the table once more and just give out some of the websites and stuff like that. We can take a 5-minute break and then pick up in the second segment and talk more about that. We can talk more about censorship and all these other things and again get a little closer to what you guys would like to see as an encouragement, indication to people listening what they can do and stuff like that. So we'll get to that in a second. But John, please add to this.
Well, I kind of occupy a unique position in that even though I'm American, I've been living in Europe for the past couple of years and work for a European company. So I've kind of viewed things from both sides. And I kind of have my foot in both worlds when it comes to nationalism. But my own position has come to be pretty close to Greg's. I mean, I think white nationalism is a great idea in the U.S. because, let's face it, most people of European descent in the U.S. are cut off from their roots. Popular American culture is more their identity these days. And the only thing that most European Americans have in common is this idea of being white. But living in Europe, I've seen, I think it would be a great tragedy to try to treat Europe as one entity. I don't think anybody here was actually suggesting that. But I like Greg and Daniel have said, I don't think there's any contradiction in cultivating a European identity alongside one's regional identity. And I would like to add, too, I don't think that identity necessarily has to correspond to the current nation states.
Absolutely.
One thing that I've learned about here in my time was I have some good friends in the Flemish regionalist movement, NSV. They had me speak at their conference last year, and I didn't really know anything about Flanders before I went there. But when I went there, I could see that they have this history of struggling to retain Flemish independence in the face of the French Walloons. And there was something beautiful there. I can see why they want to retain that. Yet, at the same time, I mean, at this conference, they had speakers from all over Europe as well as myself. And it was obvious to me that they also, alongside this very narrow regionalism, they also had a very good understanding of what was happening in Europe. I mean, they even had Alexander Dugin as a speaker, which shows that, you know, they were thinking globally, not just on this very localized level. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, really enriches Europe, is having all these local identities. And, you know, I would like to see something akin to, you know, what the Holy Roman Empire was to Europe 1,000 years ago. I mean, where, you know, you have this overarching organization that can look after European interests in terms of, you know, the threats that face it from the outside, and to help deal with internal problems and distribution and so forth. But, you know, at the same time, have a lot of a large degree of autonomy within the various regions, and to allow for a great deal of cultural differences. Because, you know, we shouldn't try to pretend that, you know, a Swede is the same as a Sicilian, you know, like have a one size fits all, you know, method of governing for all of Europe. I think that would be very tragic.
No, yeah. I don't think anyone would say that. I mean, I'm certainly not saying that. I think we need to get some things clear. I mean, a lot of these things that we think of as nation states are really empires. I mean, Germany is an empire. It's a conglomeration of a number of different formerly independent regions and states. Mm-hmm. I think also people have local identities and regional identities that stretch across nation states. I think it is the nation state as a concept that is no longer really, it's outmoded. To return to one thing that Greg mentioned, that the Czechs and the Slovaks, they're going to get back together. Look, they are back together. They, within, on the ultimate level of politics, which is friend and enemy distinction, which is that ultimate level of violence, which ultimately defines politics, they are in the same entity. They are in NATO. They are basically living in the shadow of NATO. What I am suggesting is not that we engage in some kind of mass homogeny. That's literally the last thing that I want. What I am suggesting really is a political entity, and it's on that highest level of politics that you must think about. It's that violence inherent in friend and enemy. We can no longer be defining friend and enemy within the race. We are going to lose if we continue to do that. We are going to have to define the ethnostate as I imagine it, and it's very similar to what John Morgan was saying of this larger empire. A greater whole that contains all of these, discontinuities and heterogeneities and so on. That is the great ideal, but it's that greater whole that operates on the level of foreign policy, that defines friend and enemy, and that prevents all of this ethnic nationalist hatred that we've seen, we continue to see. This is not how we're going to win the future, is by hating our white neighbors. And that is what ethno-nationalism is about. And it's what it has been about and what it continues to be about to this day. So again, I'm a dreamer. I am a total utopian. I admit it. But I think that if the white race is really to be in a position where we can develop, where we can, you know, untap these Faustian elements within our soul, we have got to do it in some kind of, we're going to have to have a state that is to some degree imperial. We're going to have to start thinking about ourselves imperially. We're going to have to start thinking about ourselves racially. And we're going to have to stop making the friend and enemy distinction within our race. So again, I would love for there to be these strong regional, like Bavarian identity. Someone who says, I am not just a German, I'm a Bavarian. I would love for something like that to occur, Welsh or Irish or Italian, or all the variations of Italian, you know, Sicilian, Northern Italian. I think that stuff is wonderful. You're connecting to your roots and your past. But it's just the problem arises when it becomes a source of ethnic hatred within the white race. So I do, you know, again, I'm a dreamer, but I think this is the way forward, And this is the way that history is pushing us forward.
Yeah, Greg, jump in here, and then I think we'll just kind of push the pause button, take a break, and then whoever want to, you know, kind of jump in after that can continue. But, yeah, jump in there, Greg.
The issue is sovereignty. The Czechs and the Slovaks have separate sovereign nations.
No, they don't.
And, yes, they do. They most certainly do. They have their own presidents, their own leaders. They're involved in a treaty organization, namely NATO. That is not something that cancels their sovereignty.
Look,
I don't believe in
you
your dream, Richard. I don't believe in your dream. I don't believe it. Your dream has been vetoed. It's never going to happen. It's grandiose. It's not going to happen.
It's been vetoed.
The best way to avoid. I veto your dream, Richard. I'm here to put the, you know. No, but seriously, reality vetoes your dream. You're never going to have the Yugoslavia back together.
I don't want that.
Of course you do. Okay, then
look,
you're...
Let's stop this. We're getting into a strongman argument. You're saying things that
No, I think... Let me speak. You've spoken for a while, okay? The issue is sovereignty. The best way to avoid conflicts, ethnic conflicts between Europeans, is for them to have their own sovereign states. The quickest way to get people fighting is to have two different kinds of horses yoked together under the same state. That's why you have the resentments between the Scots and the English, right? That's why you have had resentments between the Czechs and the Slovaks. They're very friendly now, but they don't have the same state. Why? Because it just wasn't a good fit. And I think that if you want to have peace and amicable relations between people who are of different ethnic groups, the best way is simply to separate and to let them go about their lives in their own way. And if you're worried about continental and global issues, then, and these countries certainly are, then they can cooperate with one another in forms of non-sovereign treaty organizations, economic blocs and things like that. That's what NATO is. That's what the EU is. And all of the latent tensions in the EU are really due to the fact that they're trying to impose a one-size-fits-all sovereign imperial order on countries that where it's just not a good fit. So I think we need to back off from these kinds of super states and super sovereign entities towards more compact, ethnically defined sovereign states, and then let them work out cooperation on an interstate level. It's worked well in the past, and I think it will work well in the future. But there's never going to be a European superstate.
Well, I think that it's also as always, the nature of the rulership of something like that. The European Union could potentially maybe work to a certain degree as some kind of bureaucracy, but at the same time, the leadership that's there now is just, you know, utterly, well, they're interested in different things, let me put it that way, than procuring the different national states that they're supposed to oversee. But, you know, guys, let's do this. So I want to give you a chance later to jump in on that to Richard and reply, and a couple other guys want to get in here as well. So let's just kind of go around the table, tell us what you guys got going on, tell us the websites you'd like our listeners to check out, and if there's anything else on that note that you have upcoming that you'd like to let us know about. Let's do that first, and then we'll take a short break, and then we'll just kind of continue the conversation here. John Morgan, let's begin with you there.
Okay, well, of course, my main project is Arctos Media, and we're at www.arctos.com. We've got a large web shop of items that we have not published, but we ourselves have published over 100 books. I think we're clocking in at about 110 titles that we've published so far. And in the next couple of months, we're going to be releasing new books in English by Guillaume Fay. We're going to be publishing his Colonization of Europe, which is a classic work in French on the immigration issue. We're going to be publishing a book by Alain de Benoist on the Indo-Europeans, the history and traditions of the Indo-Europeans. We'll be publishing another book of essays by Julius Evola. I haven't decided on a title for it yet. It's a translation of a book that was originally published in Hungarian, that's Handbook for Right-Wing Revolutionary Youth. Well, I don't know. We might keep that title. We have that. There'll be another book by Alexander Dugin, the second half of the Fourth Political Theory, and a lot of other things, too. We've got some new novels by the wonderful American novelist Tito Perdue coming out. We're publishing his Williams House series of novels right now, which is set in the American South at the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, we spoke with him recently, by the way. Great gentleman.
Oh, yeah. I really like him a lot. I could keep going, but people can always go to our Facebook page or sign up for our mailing list to find out what we're publishing. We publish several books every single month. Oh, we also just published a Hungarian translation of Daniel's book, The Real Right Returns, which I have to say is our best-selling book ever. It seems to have really struck a chord with people. Both the English and the Swedish editions have been doing extremely well. So it's a good introduction for people who want to find out what the new right is about. And also, I just want to mention the new blog site that Daniel and I started with some others called Right On. And it's at www.righton.net. And, our idea behind it was to have sort of a right-wing blog in English with a somewhat more European perspective. That's been going for about 5 months now.
Yeah, Richard, let's go over to you.
Sure. Well, ratingsjournal.com is a very good place to start with everything that I do, but you can also find us on YouTube or SoundCloud or Twitter, places like that. I would mention that, because I haven't plugged this yet, we're actually hosting a conference on March 5th in Washington, D.C., and the great Kevin McDonald will be on hand. I will be speaking, and there's someone else. I can't remember his name.
Ramsey
it's Ramsey Paul. Ramsey Paul will be there as well. And it's going to be a great conference. We're actually going to talk about the Trump phenomenon, and we're going to also eat and drink and make merry. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. If you go to mpievents.com, you can learn about that or register. Or if you just go to ratingsjournal.com or mpiamerica.org, you can see a link to events, and you can see what we're up to. But it's, these things are a lot of fun. It's a great place to, it's great to eat and drink, meet some of these people you've been interacting with on Twitter, make new friends, network. I really look forward to these. So I'm very excited. I'm very excited to hear what Ramsey Paul has to say as well.
Yeah, Greg, what do you have going on?
Well, the website, again, is counter-currents.com. Arctos started just a month or two before us, but they really left us behind in the dust in terms of the number of titles they published. However, I'm really happy that this coming year we're going to be bringing out books by Anthony Ludovici, Francis Parker Yockey, Evola, Maurice Bardèche, San Lu, Jonathan Bowden. And I'm even more excited, though, I have to admit, that I'm bringing out a bunch of stuff by myself, too. So in 2016, there are going to be Polish, French, and Spanish translations coming out of my book, New Right versus Old Right. And apparently there are translations underway of that book into Czech and Estonian, too. So that's very exciting. And I've also got a new book out called Truth, Justice, and a Nice White Country. They're already working on a Swedish translation of that, apparently, which is very gratifying. This spring I'm going to be in Europe. I'm going to be in Poland and Hungary and in Berlin. And so if anybody wants to meet up and network and talk, please get in touch with me at editor@counter-currents.com.
Oh, and I'll be actually appearing with Greg in Berlin. Do you remember the date, Greg?
I think it's the 10th of March. Yeah, March 10th.
Where can people go to find more info about that?
Just email us.
Okay.
That's the best way to find out. It's still sort of nebulous right now.
Right.
But it's coming together, so I'm very excited about that.
Are you going to be arrested for doing this in Berlin? I am.
I don't know. I don't think I'm going to be doing anything wrong. I'm just trying to get my life together.
I'm joking, but it's actually kind of a serious concern.
Yes.
Right. Well, actually, it will never happen in Berlin. It doesn't work that way. I think what we went through in Hungary was like a one-time thing. I don't think we will ever see that again in anytime soon, at least, and especially not in Germany. Germany is very similar to Sweden when it comes to like freedom of speech, which means it's like
almost worse in certain aspects, isn't it? Considering the history and all that, but yeah.
Well, in some aspects, but in many aspects, Sweden is worse because our like anti-racist law is so it's so confusing that it's kind of impossible to know when you're breaking the law and when you're not. So
right. Well, okay. I wanted to ask you. I'm trying to go just and wrap up here. It's unbelievable how long it takes to have five people on, but it's good. It's all good. Now. Donnie, is there anything you want to add? We got the skinny from John here just now, but is there something you want to add in terms of something you have upcoming or any other additional websites you would like to give up?
Well, of course. I mean, I will be giving a lecture in Belgium on February 28th, I think it is, in Antwerpen.
It's the 27th, actually.
And everything you need to know about this, you can access through the NSV Facebook pages. Basically, they even created some sort of Facebook event for this, and I will be speaking mostly about the differences between the new right and the old right, and a little bit about my book and so forth, and also I want to make sure to mention. I don't know if John mentioned this before, but we are currently, with our new website, rightarm.net, we are currently covering the Iowa caucus, and we already published a few articles, I think four articles, pretty much once per day, for the last 4 days, and we have several more coming up, so make sure to visit rightarm.net to stay updated about the super important Iowa caucus.
All right, Ramsey Paul, last up here. People can, of course, see you then in DC at the NPI event in March. Got something else going on?
No, I'm just celebrating Happy Holocaust Day. It's today, right?
Oh, is that today?
Yes, it is.
Wow, congratulations, everybody.
Yeah.
Happy Shoah.
And- Let's get the show on the road. And I'm going to be speaking to Amran in May. And Greg, I might be in Hungary this spring. I think, in fact, I will. So maybe we'll get together. So I'd like to see you and meet you. That'd be good.
That'd be great. You know,
yeah.
Buy you dinner.
Oh, that'd be good. And anyone can just do Ramsey Paul and see my videos and everything else. I'm active on Twitter and all that. So.
I think I have an extra ticket to Parsifal. Yeah, so maybe we should talk about the compare dates and things like that.
Yeah, and I've met John Morgan there before, so we had a good time. I have some interesting people for you to meet, too.
Oh, great. Cool.
All right. Well, excellent, boys. Let's just kind of take five here. We're going to pick up then after the break much more to get into censorship. Let's talk a bit more about if wanted to wrap up some thoughts here on you know, nationalism and groups and cooperation over national boundaries and all that kind of stuff. Much more to get into after that. But all right, short break coming up. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. Before we continue with the second hour, I just want to let you know that we have over 1,000 shows available on our members' website. First hour, always free, sometimes both, like today. But we have tons of members' exclusives for our subscribers. So do take a look. RedEyesMembers.com is the site. Go there to sign up and tune in. It's only €6 per month. We have 3-month subscriptions all the way up to 2 years available for you. All right, thank you for considering and for supporting independent alternative media. Let's get back to the show. All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us here in the second hour. We are speaking with five gentlemen within the alt-right, on the alt-right, whatever you want to say. And we have much more to discuss here in the second hour. We do need to get to, in terms of strategies for 2016 or what to do, what these guys would like to see people get involved in and what they should put time on and everything else. We kind of began speaking about that in the break a little bit in terms of, you know, kind of the success of what you've been doing, Ramsey Paul, in terms of, you know, doing comedy. And it's one of the most difficult things there is, but, you know, you make it in a really basic way. I mean, largely in front of the webcam, you're, you know, in different environments now and then, but usually that's where you're at. And it's still, people are hungry for that. I think that if much more like that was done, if people got into, you know, things that could be filmed, even if it's plays, we were talking about Michael Walker's The Return of Odysseus, for example, if that could have been filmed, what a great addition that would be. But what do you think, Ramsey Paul? Tell us a bit about how, you know, your procedure and the way you're, did this kind of evolve just for you organically, or did you set out with a plan that this is kind of what you wanted to do and get it to this stage?
Oh, it's what I wanted to do. And the reason I did it, interestingly, and we can get into the subject, is how do you convey something and still get around the censors and censorship? And when you have comedy, you see, it's everyone's just loose and they're having fun. So you can really get across the message to people in a way that's not threatening, right? Because the way our enemy perceives us is we're these angry men and we're just all upset about the world. And if we're having fun and we're laughing, that's is totally a different paradigm than they're trying to put us in. So that's why I did it. I just have fun with it. And I keep it short so people can, because, you know, if you're going to reach the mass of people, they want something they can just spend a few minutes on to get the message and they move on. And so I found that's been effective.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's not really, it doesn't, I mean, it takes time, of course, right? But there's not a lot of, I would reckon, resources and everything that goes into it.
Right.
Because, I mean, if we want to get people involved in doing these kinds of things, whether it's, you know, skits or some kind of comedy stuff, it's stuff you can do with a cheap DV cam these days, right?
Oh, and we're seeing a lot of people besides myself do it now, too, like Uncuck the Right. He's done a lot of great stuff.
Some great stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and just really, really professional stuff, too. So we're seeing a lot of stuff happen now that gets people to laugh, and it gets the point across that the just normal person will read. Because, you know, a lot of intellectual stuff is really good, but the average person won't take time to read it. But they will watch a video about something that's kind of silly or whatever, and it's a way to get our point across to what I call normal people.
Right, right, exactly. Now, is that where the metapolitical kind of issue lies, gentlemen, in terms of what you would want to see people do in this year and ahead in terms of where they should put focus? I mean, that's a broad question in itself because there's so many different things that needs to be worked on, if you will. It isn't just the one thing. But if you guys could, you know, put one or two things forward that you'd like to see people do and get involved in, what would that be? Anybody who want to jump on that?
Well, I guess I'll jump in. I think we're going to probably all amplify each other on this one. One thing that I would not like to see is a lot of politicking. I don't think we should waste our time. What I would like to see is just 1,000 flowers blooming. I want to see people writing novels. I want to see people doing the Ramsey Paul type stuff, the really, you know, fun and light YouTube videos. And heavy stuff of publishing those big books that are going to be, you know, read by fewer people, but are maybe, more deeply important. I just think we should create a culture. We should create some real alternative that people can go to. And I think that's what we're all doing. So I think in a way it's just, you know, more of it, more variety, more people need to kind of get in the act. Another thing I would add real quick is, one thing that we haven't mentioned that really has been occurring across 2015 are smaller meetings. And a lot of these would coincide with a bigger meeting. You know, it's people getting together when they go to the MPI conference, the Ameren conference, or something like that. There have been a tremendous amount of smaller meetings through the rightstuff.biz, their forum, that have just been happening organically. And I've actually heard a lot of people, I've talked to a lot of people who have gone on these. And really, really great, well, you know, obviously it's a mixed bag, as you would imagine. But within this mixed bag, there's some really great people who are showing up. So this idea that we're meeting on our own, that we're just, you know, and we don't have to have a conference, you know, with speakers and podiums. Maybe it's just grabbing a glass of whiskey and, you know, eating dinner together. I think that is great. And I think we should just do more of it. Like, you know, you're on Twitter and you're interacting with someone. DM them and go have a beer with them. Things like that are really small and really easy. They're really powerful.
I think Richard's definitely right. The problem is that we really all we can do is more of what we're already doing, and you know, certainly I will be. But you know, let's face it, we're very limited in terms of resources. And while we can do a lot with what we have, I mean, it's going to be hard to break out into. I mean, I mentioned earlier about you know, I would love to see you know, films made from our perspective eventually, but it's obviously beyond any of our means, even collectively right now. So, I mean, sometimes you know, Richard and I do these podcasts on movies, and you know, sometimes I see comments from people like, "Why are you talking about this Hollywood trash, you know, it has nothing to do with our cause." And it's like, well, I would love it if we had films that were being made by our people, but, you know, it's not happening. So we, you know, what we try to do is, you know, look for themes that are relevant in the stuff that is being made. And, you know, there is some good stuff coming out in spite of all. I think that should be the goal eventually. It's probably not going to happen in 2016, but, you know, maybe in the next 5 or 10 years we could see that or, there kind of is a right-wing music scene, already, I would say, but, you know, we probably see more of that.
Yeah, like, how about music videos? I was, all things, we're doing a video, and I happened to stumble across an Iggy Azalea video, and I had to, like, wash my eyes after that. It was just some of the most worst thing I've ever, it's just, I can't even describe it. Anyway,
I fortunately don't know what you're talking
about. Okay, good. Well, thank God. Don't search for it. Don't look it up because, you know, it's better that way. You cannot unsee or unhear that. But anyway, my point is music videos is a pretty easy way. It can reach a lot of people and stuff like that. This takes organization again. It does take resource and everything else. But I'm on with you there, John. I want to see, like, people kickstart this in some way. It's an encouragement to people out there listening as well to get involved and do something. Start a website where you, you know, produce video content to musicians that you like or get in touch with them. It's really about the networking, though, right? That's really where everything boils down to be able to find the right people and to bring your means together with them, because we can't fund all of these things and produce all of these things on our own. So I guess it's boils down to a network. What do you guys think?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I also just wanted to mention, too, you mentioned videos. And, I mean, things like YouTube are an amazing tool. Like, I was just reading the other day that they were saying that the really decisive factor that the big American TV networks are looking for in late-night shows right now are things that people will view on YouTube the next day. That now they're actually crafting sequences on, you know, the new Colbert show and I forget the names of the other guys right now, but you know, that can be broken down into a 2 or 3 minute video on YouTube. And that's actually something we could do. I mean, you don't have to have, you know, millions and millions of dollars to make a really snazzy, you know, 2 or 3 minute video. So yeah, that I think that you're onto something there, that could be something we should look into. That probably would have more appeal in some sense even than a full length movie. Or would reach more people.
Well, exactly. It's the idea that it's shorter. I've been thinking about short films, short movies, whatever you call it, of you know, even 10, 20 minutes, maybe even shorter than that, even 5, just, and that still contains a core of you know, a message that would come across and be put out. But, Greg, I know you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, I want to encourage everybody to do something, but as soon as I say that, as soon as the words leave my lips, I have this anxiety. Because, of course, you know, politicians are always wanting to do something, too. And really, the first thing we have to do is do no harm. I actually wrote an article called First Do No Harm years ago about this. It's like everyone wants to do something. Everybody wants to get involved. But do something good. That's the important thing. Everybody needs to do something good. Everybody's good at something, right? Find what you're good at and do it. And be as open about your beliefs and as involved in our cause as you're comfortable with, right? But then I want you to push and expand your comfort zone a little bit so you can do more, right? If you can't produce content, if you can't be an activist in some way, please, for the love of God, at least donate money to those who can. But, you know, we will cease to exist as a people if the only thing the people who are listening to this do is just consume free information off the internet. And enough of that. We have to move from being consumers, passive consumers of free information on the internet, to being people who support change, to be part of the change that we passively now want. And so donate, create content, become active. But whatever you do, make sure that it's good and actually adds value rather than detracts from the cause, and I'll be happy. That's all.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, you mentioned that before, Greg, and it should be underlined, I think, again, in terms of, at the very least, people that are supportive of the cause. And again, if they might not have, you know, time or even interest in that sense to contribute in producing something, donate, you know, and get involved in that way. That's the very least that people should do. And think about, you know, the future, and think about all the things that you're spending money on that is, you know, kind of making things worse, basically, for all of us, even if that's your health and whatnot. So I
think
can't,
about,
you know.
Think about how much money the average person spends on cable TV every
right,
month.
Of course.
To pay for enemy propaganda, for enemy sewage, basically, of the mental variety to be pumped into their houses and their heads. It's disgusting. I'd be very happy if a few people listening to this canceled their cable and gave the equivalent amount that they spend every month on cable TV to Countercurrents, or anybody else for that matter, as long as it goes into the cause rather than into the enemy. Another good thing that Richard did mention, I think, is these local meetups. I've been campaigning for that for a long time. I think that these are better than national meetings. They're cheaper and they produce a thicker on the ground kind of community, which is what we need. In 2015, organized 11 events in New York. In 2016, we're having monthly events again. A friend of mine's helping out with organizing those things. I'm speaking around the country. I got together with people in Augusta, Georgia, and Atlanta, Georgia earlier this month. And I think that's very, very valuable. And there's a really nice group of people in the greater New York metropolitan area. We have always had... Okay, New York has always been our biggest city. It's always been our biggest city ever since we started Countercurrents, and I'm finally meeting a lot of the people who made New York our biggest city for more than 5 years now, and it's really quite encouraging. So I think we're all going to do more of that in 2016.
Very good. Mrs. Spencer?
Yeah, that's definitely happening. It's happening behind the scenes, and I think that's great. I would just add real quick, I'm taken by this metaphor, and I think my friend Romain Bernard was the one who introduced it to me, but this metaphor of Inception from Christopher Nolan's film of the same name, and it's putting an idea in someone's mind that they're not even conscious of, but that actually informs their life and their production. I think it's one thing to say that, you know, one day we should be making movies or something like that. Well, maybe Richard Spencer and John Morgan, maybe we shouldn't be making movies because we're not the best people at it. Maybe we should be incepting people who are already doing it. And, you know,
I would agree.
Yeah. And, you know, and that is happening to a degree where, you know, there, obviously tons of stuff that Hollywood produces is total shit, but you know, there are people, there are the occasional Nolan, there's the occasional Kubrick, who will, you know, explore ideas that are of great interest to us. And so, you know, as opposed to rebuilding an alternative Hollywood, maybe what we should be doing is incepting, you know, the next generation of people who are going to explore our ideas without even knowing it. That's the best kind of influence.
Right. You mean instead of building it all over again, try to get people, the likelihood of that is kind of slim, I guess, in terms of who's controlling it and the producers and whatnot, but getting the people that are already involved in the production and everything over to our side, right? Interested in exploring different ideas, basically. That would be an idea.
Yeah, like
ideal.
Whenever the conservative movement, on those rare occasions where the conservative movement in America have produced art, it has been some of the worst things you could ever imagine. It's just been it's been propaganda, really, in the worst sense of the word, in the sense of just, you know, bald, insulting, cringe-inducing, you know, vote for low taxes as art. And I think that's the opposite of what we want to do. You know, we want artists to be artists. And if we can kind of incept them, if we can plant seeds that they're not even aware of, I think that would really be the that's something that our movement can do, and I think that is kind of part of our metapolitical mission.
Donnie, what do you think people should put focus and time and resources on?
Well, to comment on what Greg said, I completely agree with his words of wisdom that first do no harm, because that is something everyone should adhere to, which unfortunately a lot of people are not doing at the moment. But it's a very, very good starting point, because I mean, at least by following that advice, at least you're not harming the cause in any way. When it comes to everyone is good at something, I think it sounds a little bit too egalitarian for my taste, but, and I don't believe it that truly. I'm sure I will be very unpopular by saying this, but there are lots of people that are, well, not that good at anything.
We all suck at something. That's what we can say. That's fair, right?
So. That is true.
And also, I don't really see any problem with people consuming. I mean, actually the fact that we have this huge base of consumers that makes it possible for us to flourish as a company, as a publishing company, for example, when it comes to Arctos, people consuming books. And I mean, it's not like they're buying useless things that have no political relevance. I mean, they're consuming information through our books and through our various alternative media sites and so forth. And what these people should start by doing, which is something pretty much everyone can do, unless you're extremely socially incompetent, which very few people are, you should consume as much information as possible and try to influence your immediate social circle and try to push them slowly in the right direction. And that is one of the most important kinds of grassroots activism I can think of. I mean, influencing your relatives, your friends, the people in your university class or whatever. And slowly kind of get them to start thinking about the important issues and maybe lending them important books. I mean, for example, some Arctos titles.
Right. Well, Daniel, at least when they buy a book, they pay for it. And really my concern is that we need to get people to stop just wanting it all for free and start putting money into the cause. I want to follow up on something you said, though, and I think this is very important. I invite people to do this all the time, or at least think about it. I invite everybody listening to this to think about whether you couldn't possibly, over the next year, actually convert one person that you know to our way of thinking. You might have to wine them and dine them. You might have to give them some books. You might have to spend a lot of time on the telephone or chatting with them online, holding their hands through the difficult moments and so forth. But I think even the least articulate among us could probably bring one person over in a year, right? And if we start doing that, and if we also impart the mission to these people that they need to do the same things themselves, right, that builds in a multiplier effect. And, you know, if you do that once, in 10 years there'll be more than 1,000 people who believe what we believe because you started this year. So everybody out there, start this year. Bring over one person and get them to do the same. You can change the world.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you on that, Greg. And also, which kind of ties into this, is to make sure to be a good representative of the cause. I mean, try to make the best out of yourself. Try to improve yourselves in any way you can. I mean, intellectually, physically, try to be a role model for the people around you. It will make things much easier when it comes to influencing them politically.
Yeah, exactly. I wondered, Greg, I mean, you mentioned that in terms of, you know, converting one person or try to speak sense to them, basically, you know, even if you can avoid taking them through the kind of the clockwork orange type of deprogramming that some people seem to need. But isn't it also about choosing your battles, because it seems that some people are, they will never budge. I see a lot of people spending time on trying to speak with their friends and family, and it almost drains them. That's where they take the battle, and they get so tired and jaded, they almost get burnt out, right? So it's almost pick one then, or something, right, that you think you can
pick one
reach through.
Who's
right?
Reachable.
Exactly, yeah.
Right, the person who might be the most important person to you might not be the most reachable person, and so you're going to be spending a lot of, or wasting a lot of your energy on that person. Pick somebody in your circle that you think is reachable, and then practice reaching them. And maybe 9 years from now, you'll be so good at it, you can finally bring your spouse over, right? Or your dad over, or something like that. But you got to do it in baby steps and build up your rhetorical and persuasive skills.
And some of the people that convert over, you'd be so surprised, at least I was, because I have so many people write me or whatever, and they used to say, you know, I hated everything you stood for, but I just had to watch it. And, you know, and eventually they're like, you know, this one lady wrote me, I just can't stand your videos. You're just horrible, racist, evil person. And she's like, where's your video? You're supposed to come out tonight. It's not out. And
yeah,
what happens?
That's great.
You get a lot of people that, I mean, we're kind of like, and I say this in a nice way, like kind of like porn. I mean, we're kind of naughty, but they want to look. And now, because there's no gatekeepers so much on the internet, although they're trying, is people, when they read, just like the BuzzFeed article, I made a whole bunch of new friends, people that wrote me that said, oh, yeah, I read this. I was always like, this one girl was a libertarian. But then she started to look at my videos from the BuzzFeed article, because they read something about us, but they can look themselves. Even though it's supposed to be naughty, they'll go from BuzzFeed to look at our material. And then they say, well, wait a minute, these guys aren't really preaching hate or anything like that. They're just talking about identity. And this kind of makes sense. I'm not 100% on board, but I can kind of relate to this. And so it's kind of not an altogether like born again Christian conversion type of thing necessarily. You see people sometimes just slowly move in and start to agree with some of your areas. And, you know, I tell them, hey, that's fine. It's okay to disagree with some areas, but this is what we're about. And I think that's more effective. So it's not just an, it's not all, sometimes you think it'd be the people that are conservatives that go over to our cause, but I have found sometimes even very left wing people have made the transition to what we stand for.
Yeah. Isn't that also, again, it's because the left is drained and hollowed out. There's nothing there. And I think most people were truly exposed to some of the concepts and the ideas that would see the reasonable arguments within it. I think it's just within the, you know, how the way it's presented, you know, by the BuzzFeeds, by the Huffington Post and, you know, the Daily Beast and all these, you know, outlets. That it becomes contorted in that way. But I think, you know, it's a successful model by keep talking and keep attracting people to it. Is there anything else that people can do to help get the word out, get the message out, spread it to more? I mean, that's point well taken, Greg, in terms of one person, but let's say on the mass scale of things, is there anything we can do beyond that to expand the reach?
I think just what people are doing when they add comments and so forth, I know that may not sound as much, but there's kind of a dynamic in groups. And I think, Greg, you brought this up once, and I saw the video where there's this one guy, remember that, Greg, just dancing on his own in some party?
Yeah, doing the dance. Yeah.
It's really fascinating. And you have this one guy dancing, and everyone else is like, oh, what a weirdo. You know, what a weirdo. And no one wants to be associated with that because everyone else is just sitting there. Then all of a sudden, another guy is the second guy that came up and danced with the other guy that is at a party. Then that kind of gave validation to it. So these were kind of like the trendsetters. And by the end of the video, the whole group is dancing because that's how these things work. You have the kind of the pioneers, but then the second people, just by lending your support, can really make the difference, because we're social animals, and most people, they want to follow what they see other people follow. They don't want to be perceived as the lone weirdo. So just by giving your support to people, even just verbally or online, it helps to convert other people. We're seeing this in the alt right now. It's kind of snowballing. It's like more and more people getting on board. So it's becoming more okay to be part of this now. You don't have to feel ashamed about it. So I think just giving your support verbally can be a big difference too.
I think that's a really good point. And one of the things that's good about that, too, is that you don't even have to avow that you are a white nationalist. One of the most powerful moments in Craig Boddicker's documentary, A Conversation About Race, is when they ask this, to all appearances, liberal cat lady, I think her name is Marianne, what about David Duke. And she'd heard of him, and she'd heard of the term white nationalism, and she said, you know, I really don't appreciate white nationalists. But then she paused and looked thoughtful and said, but I can sympathize with their sense of loss. And I thought, that's the most powerful moment in the video, because she's outside of our camp, but she's validating us from outside. And this is why I love Jack Donovan, because he doesn't avow to be a white nationalist, really, but he talks to us, he engages with us, and he's providing external social validation to us. And I think that's tremendous. So if you want to do one thing and you're really, really, you know, just want to dip your toe into the pool before you wade in, just give some people some external social validation. That can be tremendously powerful in getting the snowball rolling down the hill.
Yeah, definitely. Now, let's talk about the – we saw something, I think it was at the end of last year, the Facebook Merkel Unholy Alliance cracking down in Germany specifically, obviously. But this seems to be something that is extending – I mean, Google has forever now been talking about for years, talking about basically returning the quote, correct, unquote, you know, search results to you so that you will be, you know, get the right sources, whatever, the hate-free sources, etc. Is this a major concern to you guys? Is this something where we have to start considering how to bypass this? What do we do to circumvent this? Because obviously, as more momentum this gains, this will be the area where they will crack down. We saw this in the UK with Theresa May, etc. It's happening all over the place, and I think it's going to be potentially unfolded in full this year. Thoughts?
Yeah, actually, I've already kind of been victimized of this new censorship policy on Facebook, because I think in their new, censorship stuff, they have some, I think they have a lot of left-wing extremists there, and apparently at least one of them kind of has targeted me specifically, because basically every article I try to market, I mean, to create a Facebook ad for, that's been written by me. It doesn't matter what it's about. It can be a pretty harmless article. For example, one of the excerpts from my book about traditional gender roles, three advice for how to be a better woman, for example. It was not approved because it was not adhering to their new policy guidelines. And I appealed it like 10 times at least, and every time I appealed it, I got it approved, and then it was active for like 10 minutes, and then it was rejected again, and I had to appeal it again, and it went on and on, like it was really Kafkaesque. It was like total craziness, and finally I just wrote to them, okay, if you don't approve this completely harmless article, which is kind of mainstream conservatism. Well, that's at least what I wrote. I will use my full network of media contacts to bring this out into the open, what you're doing to censor conservative thoughts on Facebook. And then they finally caved in and approved it. But I had to fight for like 2 weeks to even create an ad for a very harmless article. So absolutely something has changed. And I think the best strategy is to fight it for as long as possible. I mean, we should definitely not just accept it in any way at all. We should make it as difficult as possible for them to censor us, and we should fight it every step of the way. And we'll probably win.
And point it out too, right? There's actually a lot of you can gain by pointing out their obvious censorship, and a lot of people actually do take the time to look at that, because it's, yeah, there's controversy around that, etc., and we can just use that to our advantage, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's good propaganda, especially if they censor pretty harmless stuff. Right. It's excellent propaganda to bring it out into the open. And also we should really, try to, I mean, because Facebook is a huge organization and I'm sure a lot of the people on their new censorship committee are, left-wing radicals that do not belong there, of course. Maybe according to Zuckerberg, but, they don't really belong there. And we should, therefore we should, like I did, for example, I said, obviously you have some employee that is not suited to be in this position because, it's totally ridiculous to censor this kind of content. And we should do that because that could actually result in getting some of the worst people fired eventually, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That is a good starting point, I think. And eventually, if it doesn't work and if they continue to censor us, we should definitely start, because we are not the only ones targeted, and there will be a lot of discontent with this. We should really start looking into alternative social platforms like VK, for example, or even creating something entirely new. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Richard?
Sure. Let me jump in. I think it's important to think about this theoretically because we've seen some maybe early skirmishes of a coming war with what Daniel just spoke about. Little things like at Nero, who's a someone who's not kind of an alt-right person who's not an identitarian, but he's had what you could call censorship from Twitter. There have been little noises, little skirmishes, but I think the coming war is in our future, and I think we should try to understand it correctly. Whenever you hear the word censorship, I think what the image that comes up in people's minds is, you know, Stalin in his office twirling his mustache and he's, you know, marking out something in a paper and having a journalist shot or something. And things like, I mean, that's a cartoon, of course, but things like that did happen in the past. I actually don't think that is our, something like that is our greatest adversary in the future. I think we've entered a new digital world where what could be thought of as morally correct censorship, that is private censorship, might actually be our greatest problem. We, you know, I think everyone approves of censorship if, say, you know, you run a restaurant and you don't want to carry that food item. That is censorship in a way, and I think everyone would agree that that's perfectly valid and legitimate. But when your business is Google or Facebook or Amazon.com and you just say, well, I'm not going to carry that idea, it can be terrible because we're in a new world, this digital world, the world of infinite reproducibility, where something like Google is much more powerful than some, you know, governmental organization that might want to censor a newspaper. If you are not on Google, at least for now, you don't exist. There was a certain kind of censorship of the Confederate flag in South Carolina. It was at least taken down from their state house. The Confederate flag vanished from Amazon within an hour, effectively, of this happening. Amazon is a massive store, for better or for worse. Again, you could say that if you're not on existing on Amazon, you don't exist. So we are facing a new kind of enemy, and it's also an enemy that I don't think the conventional right really understands, because they like to think in terms of private censorship is perfectly fine, public censorship is the problem. Well, actually, private censorship is the problem. And so this is a new enemy, and I don't think we really I'm talking about it now because we need to have a conversation about it, because I don't think we really have any answers. I like the idea of, we could say, let's just start our own Twitter and it will be totally free and we'll be able to say what we want. But, you know, the whole point of something like Twitter or Facebook is the network effect. It's the idea that you're having a conversation with the world and everyone's there and it's all public. If we just created our own little walled garden, no one would want to be there because it would lack that, you know, je ne sais quoi of the actual Twitter. So anyway, I'll just leave it at this. We are facing a tremendous struggle and private digital censorship. And I think we as a movement, we need to start thinking about what we're going to do, because I don't think we have any real answers yet.
Well, are you going to jump off here soon, Richard?
I'm very sorry that I have to go. I have a conference call in about 5 minutes. So,
right. Well, tell us if there's something you'd like to leave us with, and then we'll continue the conversation here with the others. But,
sure. Great. I mean, just, you know, you can find, if you Google my name, you'll certainly find me. Don't believe everything you read. RadixJournal.com is a good place to start, or find us searching Radix on YouTube or Twitter, or my name on YouTube or Twitter. And also, if you're interested in coming to our conference with the one and only Ramsey Paul and Kevin McDonald and myself, check out mpievents.com or just Google that. And Google hasn't censored us yet, so you can find it. It's going to really be an exciting event in Washington, a lot of good, great ideas and friends and food and drink and things like that. So anyway, it's definitely a pleasure to be on, so thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming here, Richard. We'll have your links and whatnot up, and we'll talk soon again, okay?
Great.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. So what Richard's talking about is the kind of the corporate terms of service violation, right? The tolerance police is there to report hurt feelings and everything else. And so we try to, you know, understand how to both circumvent that, but also potentially, you know, create new platforms or whatnot. But what's the way out of that? Is it to maybe strategically try to find those maybe gray zones or areas that they quite don't know if they should censor it or not, and then kind of press on those points to further kind of move the goalpost, or should we just avoid it altogether to get involved in that? What do you guys think?
Well, yeah, and I had some issue of this because of my videos and stuff. I learned long ago how Google does their censorship. Remember YouTube? You know, they can't censor every video. There's just so many videos. So what they do is someone flags it, they send it to offshore help, basically, like India. And those guys, they don't know. They just look for key words that are naughty. For example, if you have a word of, I won't even say it, of a certain ethnic group that echoes, do you guys know what that means? You're going to be in trouble. And see, I just used a code there. And so I made up the word fin. And because everyone knew what I meant, but they couldn't really censor it because it's okay to say things against Finnish people. They're just white. They don't have special protections or privileges. So the key is, and this is why censorship is really an impossible task if we know how to get around it, but you just don't say certain things explicitly, and people will understand what you're saying. And it becomes kind of a game. It's become a game on Twitter. It's become a game everywhere. People will just make up new words that mean something else, but everyone knows what it means. So these censors are fighting a giant game of whack-a-mole. They're trying to whack everyone down, but it's almost impossible because people are just they mutate, and that's what's so great about it. And even years ago with the Soviets, they eventually couldn't censor things because of the fax machine. But we have a bigger technology, and they're fighting a losing battle. I think we'll win this because we can just keep mutating. We can say it in different ways. We can get our ideas out that do not violate the term of service. You know, we're not saying any naughty words. And we can still get our message across. That's the key thing. And that's why everyone's asked, you know, like, you know, how I've kept my videos up all these years is because I follow the terms of service. I know not to put up certain videos that will get it pulled down. Years ago when I first started, this one lady I knew, she's put out a video like, the Jews will censor the internet. And I told her, I'm like, you can't have a title like that. They're just going to censor it, you know. And she didn't believe me. She got her, you know, account shut down because of that.
So she was right.
Yeah, she was right, ironically. So you got to be kind of smart how you do this, and you just can't. But that's what our enemy did, right, years ago when they were being subversive. They wouldn't come out and say it. So we need to learn how to be a little bit subversive because we're not the establishment. We're kind of the anti-establishment. So we have to learn to work in these manners that aren't always obvious to everyone else, especially the censors.
Right. So eventually, maybe even people who are, let's say, not on our page, who end up using some of the same, you know, code words or terms, and if the terms of services change to include those things, they will end up in trouble, right? So it will almost be a way to kind of disrupt the entire service, which is going to work against the corporation or, you know, whatever service you're using, right?
Right, or what I use a lot of satire. And satire is very hard to censor because on the surface, you're supporting whatever the topic is, but you're kind of making fun of it, really. And it's hard for a lot of people, especially in other cultures, to understand really what you're doing because, you know, if, let's say they outsource this to India and they're like, well, no, he's supporting the, you know, this issue. There's nothing wrong with that. They're not. So they don't know how to deal with that. So satire can be a very good way that you don't get censored, and humor can. It's been a long ways in our history that people have used that to get to bypass the censorship. So we have these various creative ways, but you just can't hit your head on the brick wall because you're going to lose. So we got to figure they have the more power. So we have to learn how to work within their rules. Otherwise, if you're going to defy their rules, they'll just slap you down.
Right, and continue to kind of push in the direction that shows the ridiculousness of what they're attempting to do, I think. Anyone else that has thoughts on this in terms of both how we can circumvent it? Yeah, go ahead, John.
Along with what Ramsey was saying, I mean, 90% of what these new regulations are going to affect are going to be, you know, people who post swastikas and use the word nigger and stuff like that. I think satire is a good way to get around it. And another thing is you have to learn to be able to talk about these issues in a language that is, you know, much more difficult. I mean, most of these people are not, you know, studying our messages. They're looking for really obvious things. And, you know, one example that came to my mind, you know, that I've drawn from the European New Right, like Alain de Benoist and Dugin and these people, is that, you know, they talk about ethno-pluralism. Hey, what they say is that, well, you know, we believe that all peoples should have rights, but of course, you know, that includes Europeans and whites too. And I think that's a good way to talk about it. I mean, I'm not trying to make it seem like I only say that as a front. I mean, I really do consider myself an ethno-pluralist. But I think when you use language like that, you know, people read it and they think, oh, you know, this guy isn't a racist. He's just saying that all races should be entitled to their identity. So, you know, I think you can find ways around these problems. And I think that that's something that, you know, the European New Right has been working on for a long time now. You know, in its own take on metapolitics. The other thing related to this I wanted to mention, though, was that when Richard used the term early skirmishes, it kind of triggered me in the sense that I do think that the reason why our problems have been relatively minor so far is that they don't see us as a threat yet. If they did, we wouldn't be able to do all the things we're doing now.
Right.
We're talking, you know, I think you're right that, you know, things are trending our way and we'll probably continue to do so. But I think something we have to keep in the back of our minds. I mean, I don't want to be alarmist. I don't think this is going to happen tomorrow. But if we do start to attract a lot of attention, they are going to start to look for ways to shut us down. How to counter that exactly, I don't know. I mean, I know Greg had some problems with Amazon because there was a newspaper article, I think it was last year, about countercurrents. And you know, as a result, Amazon canceled one of the programs he was participating on there. I mean, that was a clear attempt to try to censor him. If we start to attract more attention, they will find ways to try to get to us and shut us down. So I can't tell you exactly what the solution is. I mean, you know, obviously we're all dependent on the internet to a very large extent and, you know, to the things related to the internet. So, the good thing is I think it's difficult to control. So maybe it would end up, you know, there'd be a situation where we would have to create our own underground media or distribution network or something like that. I don't know, but, I do think we have to bear in mind that if we're actually successful, we're going to encounter a lot more resistance and, you know, we're going to have to start thinking of ways to get around it.
Well, exactly. And Greg, I mean, that points to some of the issues you were struggling with, and it goes to the idea of also them trying to target you financially, going after payment services and these kinds of things, which really goes beyond censorship. It's a you know, an attack on your ability to survive and have a livelihood, basically.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's just one way. I mean, there's other. I mean, with these new hate speech laws, you know, Theresa May, you know, the Home Office Secretary in the UK, seems determined to make a name for herself for cracking down on these people. And I forget his name at the moment, but there was one American who was actually forbidden to enter the UK last year for a conference of the traditional Britain group. And Cushman. Yeah, and I actually, I saw the document that they sent it to him because he shared a copy of it with me. And the stuff that they accused, that they said, that this was hate speech, which was extremely mild. So it was obvious to me they were just looking for an excuse to block him. So I think as we get more successful, we have to, unfortunately, expect more of this kind of thing. I mean, I think it was just 1 or 2 weeks ago that Facebook announced that they were donating €1 million to a new anti-hate speech campaign. It was designed to clean up Facebook.
Yeah.
I think we're just going to see more and more of that kind of thing. And
I think that we've gotten too big to be censored at this point. I think there are too many of us, and I think that, if the government really is snooping as much as we think they are, they already know that there's too much of this stuff out there for them to clamp down on. I really believe that. I do think that we should fight everywhere we can in terms of, rebranding, being sneaky, migrating from platform to platform. This is a guerrilla warfare kind of operation. But at a certain point, I also think that some of us need to focus on aggression, offense. We need to, everybody needs to pick up Vox Day's SJW's Always Lie, because that book talks about two instances where people like us, basically, people who live in their mother's basement and masturbate a lot to anime, right? People like us, losers like us, actually trolled the mainstream to the point where they rolled back SJW stuff. They rolled it back in Gamergate, and they rolled it back to the Hugo Awards. And it was very, very inspiring to see how that happened. And we've got lots and lots of people, lots and lots of trolls in basements out there. And, I can now put a thing on Facebook and just tell people in little forums, troll this person, and they'll go out and they'll do it, right? And I haven't even tried to put together a vast army yet. Just wait. is Greg Johnson building an army? Yes. But anyway.
Awesome.
But the point is that we can start rolling this back. We can find out who these little worms are at Facebook and Google, and we can start screwing with them, right? If they screw with us, we can screw with them. Here's another thing. There's a really, really good book about L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology called Barefaced Messiah. It's a chilling book about a sociopath, basically Hubbard, and the organization he created, Scientology. But, Scientology actually went toe-to-toe with the U.S. government, with the Internal Revenue Service, and they beat them. That's something. Hmm. And they did this in the pre-internet era. It took a lot of organization and energy. We can do a lot of this stuff very, very easily and cheaply and distributedly and anonymously now. But it's a very inspiring tale. So we need to start taking the struggle to them. We need to start targeting these people who are targeting us. We need to start, figuring out who they are. We need to find out the weak points. We need to start getting these people fired from their jobs and things like that. And these people are obnoxious, abusive, and evil people, and they routinely violate the terms of service that they hold up over our heads. Okay, so it's easily done. We can hoist them by their own petards. And the other thing we need to start doing, and I've already been in conversations with people about doing this, because we have an enormous number of highly, highly skilled IT people in this cause.
Right.
We need to start creating our own platforms. Eventually, we will have to migrate to other things if Facebook continues and Twitter continues this direction of censorship. It's going to have to happen. And, it's hard to get things started because you need a whole bunch of people adopting it at the same time. We're going to have to create new payment platforms and things like that. But these things can be done. We have the people who can do this. We just need the capital and the time. But these things can be big businesses, right? We have entrepreneurs. Yeah. We actually have tech entrepreneurs who are in our circles now. We have people who have started multiple companies. We can do this. If we have to, we'll do it. And I think that at this point, again, I think it's really become an unstoppable thing. And I do think that the establishment, the people who know what's going on, realize there are too many dissidents to stamp us all out. And they're going to have to start figuring out different ways of managing this. They're going to have to start managing their own decline, because I think that that's what's going on.
Well, I think one of the plus sides here, too, is that the alt-right is really decentralized, right? It's many different cells, it's many different groups and people and all that stuff. I mean, despite, again, BuzzFeed's, you know, kind of take me to your leader, you know, kind of concept of reaching out to you, Ramsey Paul, they're old school in that way. They're looking for, you know, where's the PR person here who represents the party or the movement or whatever, which means that there's no core kind of to target, really. They might be able to shut a few down here and there, but they can't shut everyone down all the time. So that's something that kind of works towards our advantage. What do you think, Ramsey Paul?
Yeah, it's interesting what Greg brought up about their fear of themselves being trolled. And it took me by surprise, because when Rosie Gray, she's a reporter for BuzzFeed, and one of my conditions is, you know, I videotape her just so I could, you know, she wouldn't mess up and misquote me. Not that
and
they ever would.
That's good. Always do that, by the way, too, what you did there. Always do record the whole thing, have it on your end, because,
yep.
Again, if they're cutting you, if they're editing you in a bad way, put it up so people can see that their sly methods and use it against them, right?
Yeah, and the thing that surprised me when he was talking about trolling, she was, like, really scared I'd get people to troll her. And she even brought that up in her article that I was giving my people, whatever that means, hints to troll her. I'm like, no, Rosie, you're a sweet lady. No one, I'm telling everyone not to troll you. But they have this fear, a lot of these, and I'm not saying she's a social justice warrior, but a lot of these social justice warriors, they're really cowards. They just want to be part of the group, the herd. And if you can isolate them, they back down really, really quick. They like to gang up. They're really the bullies. They always say they're anti-bully, but some of the biggest anti-bullies are themselves bullies, and they like to be with a crowd and to try to intimidate you. So if you can isolate them, that really changes it quite a bit. So, yeah, they're not the most courageous people by their nature, because they're part of a group.
Well, isn't it, I mean, to them, to a certain extent, it kind of is a popularity contest, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of what drives some of these people. They're just trying to figure
social
out.
Signaling. Yeah, social
yeah,
signal.
Exactly.
Yeah, and to believe the right things and say the right things, because that's always what they've been taught. So, but there's a lot of people that I think that are, even Rosie, I don't think she'd ever come out and admit it, but I think she even has some, like, you know, maybe they do have a point on some issues. So I think a lot of people really are secretly somewhat sympathetic with what we do.
Yeah, when it comes to the decentralization of the alt-right, I don't really view that as a problem. I mean, the important thing is that we are able to have an open dialogue, and that we are able to kind of seek out complementary relationships and try to not compete within the exact same fields and so forth, kind of have some sort of coordination. I don't really, when it comes to metapolitics, I'm not really a strong believer in this kind of top-down hierarchical organization. I mean, that's
right, that's what I meant too, Daniel. There is, like, the alt-right is decentralized, which is our strength, right? That's what, you know,
right.
That's what's so good about it.
Yeah,
there are
exactly.
No elders of Zion on our side, right?
Right.
And there are no protocols.
Not that we're going to talk about.
Exactly.
You can't bring that up.
That's a secret, of course. But officially, we are decentralized, and no connections.
You know, all joking aside, guys, we really are. I mean, you can't get five of us on a conversation without us disagreeing about things. Stock off. And,
exactly.
And,
exactly.
But that's part of the strength.
Yeah.
I just read this book by The Occult War that was brought out by some friends in Sweden. And I'm writing a review of it called The Paranoid Style, because this is a really, truly paranoid style sort of conspiracy theory of history. And it's just naive. History doesn't work that way. when you see a school of fish or a flock of locusts moving like a vast army, it's not because there's a guiding intelligence there that's giving them orders. What's going on? It's simply they are all wired the same way to respond to the same objective stimuli, right? And so you can get order without an encompassing design to it, okay? And metapolitics works the same way. Social phenomena emerge the same way. Once everybody has the same templates in their head and they see the same reality, they will respond in the same way. And so our goal, namely to reprogram everybody's minds so that a new order emerges spontaneously, is already prefigured in the way that we go about this, which is that we do not have some sort of top-down organization, some sort of guiding intelligence. We've got lots of little intelligences that cooperate a little bit, but then they sort of go their separate ways. We cross-pollinate and so forth. And that's one of our strengths, because they'll never get us all in the same room to arrest us, right? You know, I mean, the paranoid style posits this idea that if we could have only gotten the elders of Zion when they were in that room jotting all that down and arrested them, we could have changed the course of history. It's naive. It doesn't work that way.
There's always be someone who wants to try to fill that role, you know, at some point anyway, I guess. But no, but it's a good thing, you know, in terms of there's no core to target. And as I said, they can manage to target some here and there a little bit, you know, but it, not everybody all the time. And again, I think if that is to occur, just by showing that and demonstrating the fear of the system is something which is going to actually further. I mean, unfortunately, we live in this kind of martyr type society now that victimhood is highly ranked. I'm not saying we should appeal to that and use that, but we can use it temporarily to at least expose them and show their kind of double standards.
Yeah, I completely agree with what both you and Greg just said, and it's the same. It works the same way. I mean, when a swarm of termites tear down a building, it's not because they conspire to do so. It's because it's in their nature, and in the same way, it's in our nature to defend our civilization. We just act according to our instincts, our sound instincts, and our rational thinking and our knowledge, and therefore it's completely appropriate to have this kind of decentralized organization, because we are not Southeast Asians who need like a strict hierarchy to perform. We can act kind of independently and still push the development in the same direction just by sharing the same basic values and instincts.
We're a virus.
Right. We're virulent. Well, we need to figure out how to become virulent, right? We need to make all their fears come true. The thing you said, Daniel, about instinct, I think is important. One of the most important papers I ever saw, one of the most important lectures I ever saw on this cause, was years ago when Kevin MacDonald gave a talk on psychology and white ethnocentrism. It's been republished. It's on the web. Because what he was doing is he was looking at all this social psychological study of implicit racism, and he was saying, yep, it's right. We really are wired to be ethnocentric. It's part of the deep wiring of the brain. It's in the amygdala. And so the question is, how do we stop racism? Well, the only way to stop racism is to institute internal conflicts within people's minds between their conscious programming in the forebrain, the human brain, and their instincts, right, in the earlier parts of the brain, the amygdala. And so, first of all, anti-racism is a form of mental illness. Let's just get that right out there, because it's creating internal conflicts, which is extremely exhausting after a period of time. And it also refocuses what we're doing, because we realize now that all of our people are really on our side. If you get down to the amygdala, if you get down to their real instincts, even the people who are trying to destroy us and shut us down still have those instincts. And so what we're trying to do is deconstruct the conscious programming that has instituted this inner conflict and get people in touch with their real healthy feelings. And once we can do that, once we can unleash the beast, so to speak, things will change very, very quickly because nature in its deepest sense is on our side.
Right. We got to appeal to human nature, instinct, just as you say. I think the social engineering that we've seen has, to a large extent, what has conditioned people to go against their basic instincts and their drives. And I think as soon as that kind of is released, people will more or less kind of fall back to a natural state. I think they can't keep this up forever. I think it's breaking down now, actually, to be honest.
And what we have too, I think we're getting, at least I've seen, is kind of the cool factor. And I know that may sound silly, but is people like to do something, you know, with the alt-right, it's kind of young, it's exciting, we're making fun of the establishment. I mean, what young 20-year-old wants to get hooked up with like Jeb Bush or something? You know, it's really boring, it's old. And, you know, we represent something new. And there's a sexual component on it, to be honest, too. When I was in Hungary at that conference that got banned, we were in a restaurant and these two guys from Australia, young guys in their 20s, and this waitress came up and said, "Oh, are you part of that neo-Nazi group?" And they're like, "No, we're not neo-Nazis, we're just for identity, this and that." She goes, "Oh, well, that's really bad," and blah blah blah. And then she's like, "Well, hey, you mind if I give you my number? Maybe you can, you know." Seriously, it happened.
And, EJ O'Rourke,
they have like there's like this bad boy sex appeal in a sense that we are. Compared to these, you know, it's no fun. Like, if you think of a leftist and you're a guy, what do you think of as a white man? You just think of some guy just really weak and you know, he's right. Ashamed that he's white. He's just so upset that he has a penis. And, you know, who can be attracted to that? So we kind of have an edge that is exciting that I've seen for a lot of young people. So there is kind of a sexual dynamic that is cool and people like it. And it's a little edgy, so that makes it exciting for people.
There are two quotes hippies. I'd love to throw in. One is Sylvia Plath from Daddy. She says, "Every woman adores a fascist." And the other was from P.J. O'Rourke, who said, "No one's ever fantasized about being tied up and sexually ravished by someone dressed as a liberal."
Right. Yeah, true dat. Yeah. John, did you want to add something?
No, I was just thinking about the fact that, I mean, not in terms of our beliefs or the way we present ourselves, obviously, but we're kind of, in a way, coming to occupy maybe, you know, the space that the hippies occupied in the 60s and early 70s, that, you know, we're sort of the
exactly.
Forbidden.
Did you read that article I wrote on that? I compared us to the hippies in the
I read it somewhere. That's actually where I got the idea.
Yeah. And that's a good analogy because we're kind of like the underculture, the counterculture, if you will. And our enemies, I think they must hate that, like Hillary Clinton, because they were raised as the counterculture. Now they're the establishment. You know, they're the man. So we have that going for us.
Well, and I think also the difference is that this is actually genuine. It's not contrived and controlled and regulated as the previous one was. I mean, let's face it, the one thing they're the most scared of right now, the establishment, is some of the ideas that we're talking about. That's why they have to go after us. In the 60s, they, to a large extent, yes, they did create some of the martyrs and whatnot, but it was a very contrived and kind of, poorly executed, you know, issue. But it was enough to attract a lot of people to it, I think. So I think we have that in our favor. This time.
Yeah, and if we don't fit in the box that they want us, and I kind of said this earlier, but one of this lady, she's a French activist, she's a nationalist, and, you know, God bless her, she was previously a porn star, but she's like on our side. So it's like we have all sorts of types of people now that are attracted to the alt-right that aren't, you know, exactly William F. Buckley types, to put it nicely.
Right.
We have a lot of interesting characters. And that's why it always comes up. People are always coming to me, Ramsey Paul, we need to purge this person from the movement or this person. I'm like, what are you talking about, purge? It's decentralized. I couldn't do that even if I wanted to. And part of us, what makes us strong, and I hate to use this, it sounds cliche, is our real diversity of ideas and opinions. And, you know, we're not just this lockstep, you know, real stuffy conservative as you think about it. I mean, we have people that are – I mean, really creative. They're kind of out there. They're kind of wild. They're funny. They're not exactly, you know, there's all different types of people, which I love. I think it makes it fun.
Are any people being held out from this, from the alt-right? As far as you guys know, is there anybody that, like, is not Well, I mean, again, since this is decentralized, it doesn't make sense, but you know.
I think all of us are by somebody.
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot of people.
Depending on who you ask.
Right.
Yeah. You go to these little internet forums and you have these threads. We should purge so-and-so, you know. We can't allow this person in. And I just laugh and laugh at that because there is no in and out.
Exactly.
In that sense.
Yeah.
There is no in and out. And generally, it's the people who are calling for purges that are the real outsiders because they don't know how this thing works anyway, you know. And I love how, Jack Donovan was being denounced as an entryist. And it's like, dude, he's already inside. You're the entryist. Come on, you know. So I just want to end on a positive note here. I think that the existing establishment is coming to be aware that there are too many of us to stop us, that events are moving in our favor, and that they are now approaching the point where they are going to have to decide. Right now, I think most of them are just in denial and they're deluded. Okay, most of them are deluded. The ones who are actually looking at reality, and that's a very tiny number of people in any political scene, but especially on the left where they're reality deprived, the ones who are looking at reality are concluding they can't suppress us, and their options now are to try and co-opt us or to try and hang on as long as possible and pray and maybe to manage their decline. That's what we're going to be seeing, I think, in the future. Co-optation, fervent prayer, and doubling down on their beliefs, right, their articles of faith, and managed decline of the left. And when they no longer have power or not, it'll be hard to tell when that's going to happen. Only the angels know, right? Even the angels don't know. But it's going to happen.
A lot of them will say, hey, I was always on your side, guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we'll really know.
Exactly.
It's like everybody
I'm
was
with
in
you.
The French resistance after the war, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, let's have some closing thoughts here, I guess. We should wrap up here so we could continue for another hour, I guess, or so. But, Donny, let's go over to you.
Sure. I just want to kind of end with a suitable quote. That ties into what we discussed before about the previous generations and their kind of fake revolution, which was supported from above, from the great identitarian thinker and author Guillaume Fay, and that is that we now have the monopoly on rebel thinking. And I think that is very appropriate because we are the only real opposition in today's Western society, and more people are starting to sense that, and that is why more and more people sense the appeal in our circles, in our movement, and are coming around to our way of thinking.
Exactly, an authentic opposition that actually offers some solutions to this, and yeah, it's clear by the very establishment that, by the way, they are trying to, shut people up and throw those usual labels on people as a measure to prevent this opposition from establishing itself by associating it with some of the worst, taboos and no-nos in our, that we have in history. So that is interesting. But I think there is an appeal within that, as you guys kind of said before. I think let's kind of check in with John and Ramsey Paul here if there's anything final that you'd like to leave us with. John?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I imagine there's some people listening who probably are sympathetic to the sorts of things we're talking about, but they're not involved in any direct way. And I just wanted to say, I mean, I myself, I stood on the sidelines for many years when I was younger. But it was 7 years ago now in 2009 when I started making this work for the alt-right or the new right, whatever you want to call it. I mean, this is all I do now. It's the main thing I do, Arctos and all of the related things that I'm doing. And I have to say, I've never regretted it. It's incredibly exciting. I mean, of course, there's ups and downs, and of course, there's disadvantages to being involved in this sort of work, but I wouldn't give it up for anything. I mean, I'm really having the time of my life. So if there are people who are thinking about becoming active and, you know, they're not sure, I'll just say, join us. It's quite an adventure.
Absolutely. Ramsey Paul, you get the last word here.
Yeah, ditto. Same thing with me. I jumped into it, and it's just been an amazing experience. The fringe, and I met, you know, John and everyone else, and it's just a great time. I mean, yeah, there's the 1% that gives you trouble, but I think people in their mind, they fear more than it really needs to be fear. In a lot of ways, our enemy's kind of a paper tiger, and if you just take a stand, they really only can do so much. So I encourage people to get out there.
All right. Well, absolutely. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate all of your time today. Thanks to Richard as well, who can join us here at the end. But we'll make sure to have the links up on the program page on Red Ice so that people can, you know, check out your work and see what you have upcoming and going on and all that kind of stuff. So I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work, lads, and I hope we can do it again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Thank you for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. We hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Always fun with roundtables. You can see our upcoming guests in our radio archive. And before we close here, let me just say thank you again for listening, and a special thanks to all our members. We'll be back in just a few days again. Until then, stay strong and take care of yourself and your loved ones. We'll talk soon.
I'm going to go to law school and move to Washington, D.C. and get a job at a think tank, and the far right is your home.
Ariel, listen to me. The Beltway world, it's a mess. Life on the alt-right is better than anything they've got over there. Your bank account's always greener in some billionaire's employ. You dream about going mainstream, but then you'll be Murdoch's toy. Just look at the blogs around you, here on the reactosphere. The dankest memes around you, why live in that world of fear? On the alt-right, on the alt-right. Darling, it's brighter here where it's brighter and proudly white. In the mainstream, they just cede ground. We let the WebEx stick around while we are hating, thinking, debating on the alt-right. Down here, Ezra's all are happy as leftist butt cheeks we bruise. The Beltway cucks, they ain't happy, and that's cause they always lose. They purge Buchanan and rich wine, are cowed by the word racist. They'd rather lose than be seen on an STLC hate list. Whoa-oh! On the alt-right, on the alt-right. Nobody purges, repudiate, urges to go out of sight. Smart set does nothing but retreat. Can't stop the sale of baby meat. We can't be blamed, silenced or shamed on the alt-right. On the alt-right. We got the means here to make couples scream here all through the night. GOP insults its own base, trying to woo a hostile race. White boats are drifting, all windows shifting towards the alt-right. The fast one to smash the monarchist LARP, HBD top race with backs they sound sharp. NRX is grand, paleo cons bland, Paul warms the souls of trolls.
Jews.
Amrin is great too, won't touch the JQ, nothing can compare to V, dare it's true. Just watch Ramsey Paul on Taki McLol.
TTRS Echo!
Oi, hey! It's like another show up. Shut it down!
Guys, I can't decide what religion I should be.
Orthodox.
Metavaganist.
Why are you still worshipping a Jew on a stick? You should be a pagan.
Cultural Marxism is a natural product of Christianity.
On the alt-right. On the alt-right. When the shit lords assault their keyboards, you're in for a night.
Cucks are just leftists from the past. We want to end modern decadence fast.
Each little racist knows what the case is on the alt-right. Each little troll here is browsing porn here on the alt-right. Each little fash here knows how to clash here where there's statistics known by autistics. We give no fucks here, there ain't no cucks here on the alt-right.
Jew on a stick.